one up.
That's 1-800-DISH, the number one up.
Handling fee and annual commitment required. Offer ends June 30th, 04. Restrictions apply. Call for details.
This is WRIM.com.
Twice. Is nice.
Who for Tuesday on the Rip. Every Tuesday, 101 WRIM,
the home of rock and roll,
brings you Tuber Tuesday. Keep it locked on the Rip all day this Tuesday for back-to-back badass blasts of your favorite Rip rock band.
Plus, the Rip gives you the hottest tickets to the coolest concerts and events happening around the Motor City.
Tuber Tuesday.
Double the Rip rock.
Double the Rip prizes.
Learn it. Know it. Live it.
Tuber Tuesday on the Rip. From 101 WRIF. If it rocks.
If it really rocks.
Well, begin transmission.
Here comes the music.
Hello.
How are you?
Hey, it's Joe and Mike, and it was Don't Stump Mike, and unfortunately for me, the subject was Friends, and I've never even seen an episode of Friends.
What city do they live in?
Oh, jeez. Wait a minute.
Give him like two notes.
Well, let me think. I mean, actually, I just want to just say L.A.
Oh, you said L.A.?
Yeah, L.A.
Oh, no.
Oh, no.
You're killing me, Greg. He was on hold for a long time.
Oh,
Greg, aren't you bummed? Aren't you going, geez. Mike, Central Perk, come on, man.
Oh, jeez, man.
Why did you think he would get New York? Why did you think that was so easy?
I knew it was between New York or L.A. I just hope he was guessed the right one.
You and Mike in the morning. Broadcast program.
On the Riff.
Riff. 101.
W-R-I-F. Riff. Rocks.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Now, the Riff's ripping rock at 9 o'clock. 1 solid hour of your Riff rock and roll request.
All the excitement and fun you can bear.
With Meltdown, the big unit on the Riff.
Your opportunity to take control of the WRIF playlist with the guy who lost control a long time ago.
Call in your Riff rock and roll requests to Meltdown at 313-298-WRIF or email them to meltdown@wrif.com.
The Rippin' Rock at 9 o'clock
with Meltdown.
He's in control.
101.
W-R-I-F.
Riff Rocks.
Hello.
How are you?
What you missed from Drew and Mike in the morning.
The King of Pop also habitually gulped down soda cans of wine, particularly when he's on airplanes. On a flight to Frankfurt in 1999, for example, his former business advisor, Ming Ho Lee, had...
I said, this is Peter Werby. And the producer says, hi, Chris, what's going on in Houston? I said, Jamila, this is Peter Werby in Detroit. Silence. Yeah. I said, she said, this isn't Chris Baker in Houston. I said, no, it's Peter Werby in Detroit. She said, oh, my God. And so anyways, it was a big mix-up. And so hopefully some of you got to listen to the show anyways. If you want to access Air America, you can just go to my website, peterwerby.com, P-E-T-E-R-W-E-R-B-E.com. I'll be on the show next week for sure. All right, happy Mother's Day. As you may or may not know, the origins of Mother's Day and the original proclamation written by Julia Ward Howe was an anti-war proclamation. Julia Ward Howe was perhaps best known for having written the words to the Battle Hymn of the Republic. You know that, my eyes have seen the glory, you know, that thing, which was essentially the battle hymn of the Republic. You know, the Union soldiers sang it as they marched off in defense of the nation. She was an anti-slavery activist, and the original proclamation was an impassioned call for peace and disarmament. In the years following the Civil War, her political activism increased, as did her condemnation of war. And then, well, I won't read you the whole proclamation. But actually, if you want to see it, you can go to accuracy.org, and you can see there where I get some of the guests for the Night Call show that you'll hear at 1 o'clock Eastern time this morning. And we have, let's see, who do we have? Oh, yeah, a couple of good folks. Paul Rykoff, who is a returning Iraq vet, and also the NPR commentator, Andrei Codrescu. So that's at 1 o'clock. It's just over about 11 now. So a lot to talk about. More images coming out, even if you can imagine. more disturbing than the original ones from Iraq. And it's beginning to sound thinner and thinner that these are just a few kind of twisted individuals that took part in this. This was standard operating procedure, apparently. This humiliation, beatings, and I don't know if you saw the one that came out today. I have it. It is so it was so disturbing to me. I guess I would say it's so disturbing as an image almost to anyone that I had to rip this off. I just have about a half a page here. I couldn't, I mean, I looked at it once and I said, this is one of the most horrible things I've ever seen. It says here in Chain of Command, this is a New Yorker article that's going to hit the stands tomorrow. Seymour M. Hirsch describes new photos he has obtained of a dog attacking a naked Iraqi detainee at Abu Ghraib prison on December 12, 2003. The photos, which had been in the possession of a member of the 320th Military Police Battalion, show the Iraqi with his hands clasped behind his back, quote, leaning against the door to a cell, contorted with terror as the dogs bark a few feet away. And that's the one I saw. And like I say, it was disturbing to the extent that I had to rip it off and throw it away. I guess people like me don't need to look at this. If you're one of those people that still holds on to the idea that there was something grand and glorious about this foolish, unnecessary, and now the evidence piles up, brutal invasion of Iraq, you should go look at this. This is what's become of our expeditionary force. And you say, well, they didn't all do it. Only a few did it. Well, let me go on with this. Hirsch reports in another photo taken a few minutes later, quote, the Iraqi is lying on the ground, writhing in pain with a soldier sitting on top of him, knee pressed to his back. Blood is streaming from the inmate's leg. Retired Major General Charles Hines, who was the commandant of the Army's military police school during a 28-year career in military law enforcement, tells Hirsch, I never would have authorized it for interrogating or coercing prisoners. If I had, I'd been put in jail or kicked out of the Army. Not in George W. Bush's Army. You got to remember, if you're doing something that is so criminal, so vile, so sadistic, that you know that if anyone found out about it, that this was just coming out of the most coarse and base and brutal nature of your own twisted personality, you'd do this in the dark of night. And that's what happens in American prisons. Inmates get the crap kicked out of them all the time. And, the guards know enough not to take photographs. But these men and women of these police and guard battalions, they knew this was standard operating procedure. They knew that it happened all over Iraq. And so they could take these photographs as little mementos of the fun that they were having with these inmates. I mean, you saw the smiling ones. Now, I hardly know what to say. This war is lost, folks. George W. Bush will go down in history. Mark my words, George W. Bush will go down in history as the worst president this nation has ever had. And, well, he should. Remember, he was rejected by the majority of people. The majority of people in America said, we don't want George W. Bush to be president. And by hook and by crook, by hook being the fact that finally the electoral votes of the Electoral College went for him, and by crook, five friends of Bush and Bush's dad say, you're the president. Now you say, geez, what a traitor. What a creep. What a commie. We have lost the war. Well, I'm not the only one that's saying that. How about this commie? Republican Senator Chuck Hagel of Nebraska. He says, I think we're right on the edge in Iraq right now. Rumsfeld and his staff didn't listen to military planners, and now the United States is in a mess, the Nebraska Republican said. What is our policy? What are we doing? What is the possibility of us winning? That's all still in question, said Hagel, a member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. A senior general at the Pentagon tells the Washington Post he believes the United States is on the path to defeat, and Rumsfeld and his advisors are to blame. The Post reports great anger is building at Rumsfeld and his top advisors among career Army officers. The current office of the Secretary of Defense refused to listen or adhere to military advice, the general said, on the condition his name not be used in part out of fear of punishment. This is not a democratic society longer, folks, at the top. Well, it's not even at the bottom. George W. Bush, four separate times, has said, my favorite form of government is a dictatorship. And he laughs, you know, like he's kidding, like he would prefer not to have the messiness of democracy. Well, once these characters are in power, that's how they function. So even generals are afraid to criticize, you know, their higher-ups. Now, there's just so much here. I mean, one of the things we don't get to talk about, of course, while all this is going on, is the fact that the United States government is going into the red at $991,000 per minute, almost $1 million per minute. This is going to be another legacy of Bushco. I mean, all his pals are getting rich. I just filled up my tank at $1.97 a gallon, and say, oh, well, you know, it's $40 a gallon, and, you know, they're just passing along the cost. Well, that's not true. All these big oil companies, big buddies of Cheney and Bush, Bushco is what I call them. You know, it's Bush Incorporated. That's what's running our country now. They're making record profits. Texaco, Chevron Texaco, I guess it is. Exxon Mobil, all of them, they're doing great. And who set this all in motion? I mean, George W. Bush now, he says he's furious. Listen to this. A furious President Bush has demanded to see all the photos and videos showing abuse of Iraqi detainees, a senior White House source said late Sunday. The president was blindsided by the first TV images. He will not be blindsided again because it's all about PR. It's all about winning the election. That's what all of this is about. Do you ever notice or note George Bush doing anything that has to do with legislation that would increase the quality of life for us here in the United States? Or is everything a photo op? Is everything a campaign stop? Is he not really just the fundraiser in chief? That all the corporations that he's done favors for, to the detriment of the average middle class and working class person. Yeah, that, I mean, that's where he's at. Now, let me see a few other notes on here. Oh yeah, when I say, and I, this is now the generals are saying, this General Odom, who was on Nightline. Sorry, I can't even remember his first name right now. He too said the war is lost. And the only way we can win it is the way the United States is going about it now, the way the Army is going about it now. There is full-scale urban warfare going on in Iraq as we speak. Whole sections of cities are under military assault by the United States and its armed forces. Hundreds of people being killed, thousands being wounded, because we're going to liberate these son of a bitches whether they want to be or not. Along the lines of what these vile right-wing characters that told us all these lies. Remember, these are the ones that said there were weapons of mass destruction. These are the ones that said we'd be welcome. They would, Rumsfeld himself who said they would throw flower petals in our paths as we came through their cities to have liberated them from Saddam Hussein. He said that there would be enough oil pumped to pay for this war. Right now it's cost $130 billion. They're thinking it might cost $200 billion. Anything we ever dreamed about our tax dollars going for to improve the quality of life in this society is just out the window for I don't know how long. I'll tell you, if you're in your teens or your 20s, when you start earning money, I mean, even if there is enough to take care of the fundamentals that government is supposed to take care of, most of your tax dollars are going to wind up going to pay off the debt that's being run up for this this war. In the meantime, of course, all of Bush's buddies that that made all the weapons to destroy Iraq and now are fighting the war and eventually may reconstruct it, you know, they're making a fortune. And we're paying the bills. We're paying the bills for it all. We're paying hundreds of millions of dollars to these mercenary firms. They've got thousands of these guys out there, all the over in Iraq, all these hot dogs that didn't join because they wanted to defend the United States, that didn't go there, like most of them, from Jessica Lynch to Lindy England, who wanted to get a college education. They like war. That's why they're mercenaries. They like going around with guns strapped and, they like the danger. They like the juice. They like the extreme life. And we're paying them. You know, we're not paying our teachers. Our cities are in debt. Our states are in debt. Our schools are laying off teachers. Our roads are crap. But hey, we got enough money to spend hundreds of millions of dollars like on Blackwater, which is one of these firms that puts out, that sends over the mercenaries. And when you think about it, think about credibility. I mean, let me put it like this. I mean, George W. Bush saying, I apologize, you know. And Rumsfeld, I take responsibility. What is this? I could break into my neighbor's home, and then when I get caught, remember, they got caught in this. I mean, this stuff has been in the pipeline about all this abuse and torture and what have you for over a year. This was going on in Afghanistan. It goes on at Guantanamo. It's going on in Iraq. Every human rights organization, the International Committee of the Red Cross, all had said this is going on. It's endemic. It's happening everywhere. Beatings all the time. Humiliations. Sexual torture. I mean, I just heard a right-wing talk show where they said they may have videos of U.S. soldiers raping young boys. So we might not even have seen the worst of all of this. And in all of this, who has turned out to be correct? There were no weapons of mass destruction. We weren't welcomed. Remember, yeah, if you've got a memory at all, and I said, we're going to be facing urban guerrilla warfare. Oh, no, they're going to welcome us. You know, don't worry about that. Oh, we're going to have all this oil that's going to pay for all this. No, we're going to get stuck paying it. So who has the credibility? How about this for methodology? How about this for a suggestion? Every time George W. Bush, Rumsfeld, Cheney, the rest of them open their mouth, assume they're lying. That's what I do. I mean, if they say it's Tuesday, I look at the calendar. Because I don't believe a single thing they say. If you think that's way too partisan or way too cynical, how about this? Just so you don't get fooled again. I mean, some of you want to get fooled. These are the, remember, you know, I always talk about the Lincoln dictum. You can fool all the people some of the time. That's what happened in the run-up to the war, because all of the media, all the liberal media, the New York Times, the Washington Post, National Public Radio, they published and announced the same lying crap that came out of the mouth of Bushko that the right wing did, and suppressed the voices who said, hey, this is all a lie. All right? So they bear a lot of responsibility for it. But still, that information was out there. And there is this third of the population that wants to live in this state of willful ignorance because they love authority. They hate anything that challenges authoritarian values. So they're going to look for some excuse to figure out why is this okay? You know, why are we still doing good? I mean, what are the evil forces behind, us being the United States winding up in this position of rather than being the conquering heroes now are being posed as, the bad guy. I always talk about the bad guys and the good guys, right? So they're hopeless. I mean, they're going to listen to all these right-wing commentators and wait for the excuses that are given every day. Because, you know, they're always in this argument against reality. I mean, reality presents itself. Here are these torture scenes, that are getting more and more brutal all the time. Remember, the first they approach it in two ways, really. There was this guest on Hannity and Combs, Sean Hannity, this vicious right-winger. And they had a guest on there who compared the maltreatment of the Iraqi POWs to fraternity hazing. Yeah, with these crazy frat rats, when they're initiating a pledge, as they call them, they mess them up and do all sorts of nasty stuff to them. Well, that's what he said this was like. He said, Tony Robinson, a former interrogation instructor, said, frat hazing is worse than what was happening in these pictures. So, what are these people complaining about? Rush Limbaugh said, let's see here. He said, here's a caller, another caller to his show. It was like a college fraternity prank that stacked up naked men. And Limbaugh, I guess he's not, is he off of drugs? I guess he is. Exactly my point, says Rushbo. This is no different than what happened at the Skull and Bones initiation, and we're going to ruin people's lives over, and we're going to hamper our military effort, and then we're going to really hammer them because they had a good time. That's what he saw in those photos. Those disturbing, frightening photographs of people being brutalized and humiliated. He saw people having a good time. And you got to remember, the fascist mentality loves sadism and brutality. They love war. They love the subjugation of people. And it's a sexual titillation to them as well. You know, these people are going to be fired at every day, Limbaugh says. He's talking about, this is the excuse, so it's two ways. I'm talking about people having a good time. These people, you ever heard of emotional release? You have heard of the need to blow some steam off? So you sick dogs on a naked man to let steam off in Rush Limbaugh's and the other right-wing ditto heads universe. This is on planet Bush. Planet Bush is out past Uranus. You know that planet, right? And he laughs, too. He says, in these American prisoners of war, have you noticed who the torturers are? Women, the babes. The babes are meeting out the torture. That's how he looks at it. But the idea, too, that if you are in the hands of the American prison authorities in Iraq, that's evidence that you're an enemy of the United States, and hence anything can be done to you. I mean, because, of course, these guys weren't being fired at every day. They were too busy sicking dogs on people and beating them up and stacking them in naked pyramids. I mean, how can these people live with themselves? Well, I don't know. Can you imagine if this would have happened to U.S. prisoners? I mean, let's go back to the Bush apology. This was only very, very few Americans. Well, it was. I mean, percentage of the men and women over there. It was a very, very few percentage of them. Can you imagine if this would have happened to Americans? If this would have happened to Americans who were prisoners of the Arabs, of the Iraqis, what would have been the American reaction if that would have happened to one or two? Think about these four mercenaries who were killed. Yeah, so I don't know. Then their bodies mutilated, which was pretty pretty disgusting. But they were dead. Yeah. And as one little kid said, well, you know, they incinerate our women and children all the time. So they didn't see much difference what they did to the hated Americans. These are guys that died in war. But can you imagine if live American POWs were subjected to being photographed naked with dogs attacking them? What we would have said about the entire Iraqi population? What, I mean, can you imagine Foxhole News? They would have had all of their right-wing psychologists on saying, this kind of brutality is deeply rooted in the Muslim psychology and their hatred for us. I mean, they would have said that had this been done to American prisoners, that this was indicative of the whole culture and not an aberration. So you might say, well, that's true with them, but not with us, because those are just a couple of bad apples. Heard that a lot, haven't you? The bad apple theory? These were a few bad apples. Well, these bad apples, quite a number of them, were actually prison guards in America. And one of them was actually implicated in another abuse scandal in the United States. And if you think, I mean, George Bush said, this is not the America I know. Well, some of the worst scandals and the highest incidences of prison guard brutality and abuse are where else? In Texas. I mean, you know, Alabama's always up there, you know, trying for first place, but sometimes Texas beats them out. Go to Google and put in U.S. prison guard abuse. I mean, if you want to spend the next, I don't know, 15 hours going through the complaints, lawsuits, descriptions, articles about it, then go and put in U.S. prison guard rapes and see what you get. You can spend another day or two on that. So this is as American as cherry pie, what happened there. Because when you give people that kind of absolute power over others, It's pretty easy to begin to exercise that in the manner that we saw, or the manner that we see in lockups and prisons all over this country. And when you start thinking about the United States has turned over any number of people that they suspected had information to torture states that our tax money goes to support, like Egypt, for the most ghastly and brutal torture imaginable in an attempt to secure information. You got to remember, a lot of these people that wound up getting tortured had done nothing. They literally were in the wrong place at the wrong time, like some of these people that they released from Guantanamo. The United States knew and supported all sorts of torture states during the 1970s and the 1980s. So this is very American. It is exactly the America that George W. Bush represents. Ultimately, this all is parked at the doorstep of the man who lost the 2000 election. And that's why we're in the mess that we're in. And we're such a bunch of damn passive people. I mean, rather than turning out tens of millions of people into the streets saying we have been had the 2000 election stolen from us, you get Gore and Clinton going to Bush's inauguration. Well, congratulations, Mr. President, even though you stole it from us. All right. I had more to say, if you can imagine that, but I suppose this is a talk show where you're supposed to take part as well. I'm Peter Werbe. This is the Night Call Show, and our numbers are 313-298-WRIF. We should be streaming to our friends all around the country and around the world at WRIF.com, RadioPower.com. You can also go tomorrow to RadioPower.org. Shelby, don't email me. RadioPower.org streams this show live, and then there's an archive edition available at RadioPower.org and WhiteRoseSociety.org as well. All fine people. All right. Okay. Let's go to our first caller. Hi, it's WRIF. You're on the air. Good evening.
Good evening. How you doing?
Doing well.
Charles Rangel may be the first testicularly endowed Democrat in the House because he's already using the I word.
Impeachment.
Impeachment.
Yeah. Yeah.
Bush said, you know, what happened in that prison didn't reflect on the majority of troops that have served over in Iraq, and that may be true, but it reflects directly upon the man that put them there.
Sure. I mean, where does the buck stop? I mean, I guess they finally told him, hey, you got to apologize. So he apologized.
And he apologized to a king. he goes on TV to the Arab masses on our, you know, our Voice of America TV stations and says, you know, heads will roll. The next day he goes to a king.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Well, the king must be his peer because he's the only one that he feels that he's responsible enough to apologize to.
Also, when he was speaking to him, I wish I had the quote completely here, but he said, we're going to stop the foreign killers that are making Iraq.
Pulling the army out?
Well, that's it. I mean, you know, actually, kill is an interesting word. It is not illegal to kill someone. It's illegal to murder someone, but it's not illegal to kill somebody. I mean, that's the kill is the act of taking a life.
Yeah.
And, you know, then one has to associate the circumstances of it. Yeah, was it self-defense? Was it an accident? You know, stuff like that.
Euthanasia?
Right. And but the only foreign killers of any proportion, I mean, there may be a few foreign, you know, like Al-Qaeda types there, but we're talking about a mass uprising against a military occupier. And that unfortunately turns out to be us, our neighbors, our sons, our cousins, our nephews.
Well, George Bush has done the unthinkable.
What's that?
He's taken my mother from condemning me for going to women in black marches.
Yeah.
Because I wasn't supporting the president. Friday where she calls me up and tells me he should be impeached as a war criminal. And
wow. Well, all right, thank you so much for your call. I appreciate it. 313-298-WRIF. Yeah, I think they're even getting to be too much for a lot of Republicans. Hi, it's Night Call. You're on the air. Good evening.
Yeah, hi, Peter.
Hi.
First-time caller.
Welcome.
Hi. My name is Bob. I'm calling from Lake Orion. I'm a Vietnam era veteran. I was a conscientious objector after I was drafted, and saw a lot of my friends just psychologically damaged after they were drafted. A lot of people I know, different people I know, got injured and killed and that kind of thing. But, you know, I started seeing those pictures of this torture over there. It started reminding me of the Deep South. I mean, you take this neocon president, you have all these conservative white males from the South all over this government, and you know, it's almost like the triumph of the Confederacy, and they have just have a long cultural history of this kind of stuff, and by them escaping the Geneva Conventions, saying they weren't going to obey that kind of stuff, man, they just kind of opened the floodgates. These kids aren't trained, they're overwhelmed. They're trying to take over a whole country, and you have the ugly face of George Bush. I mean, just being emanated globally, and you know, it's the face of ugly America. It's an underside that this country has tried to hide for a long time, and it's being exposed. And this guy's got to go, or we're in bad shape.
Well, I think the only thing that George W. Bush and his handlers and these reprehensible characters like Cheney and all these other neocons, who was it? Paul Wolfowitz, who said, yeah, we've lost about 500 men. And someone had to say, hey, you're the Assistant Secretary of Defense. It's 600 or 770.
Right.
I mean,
right.
This guy doesn't even know how many American kids have died for his mistake. I mean, yeah, they got to go. You're right. Thank you, Bob. Appreciate your call. Hi, it's WRIF. You're on the air. Good evening.
What's going on, Pete? Joe from FC here.
Hi, Joe.
I wanted to talk about the draft later, as your last caller was talking about it, because I've actually heard from two friends here this week that 35 is the actual age that they're going up to. So unless I'm going to turn 36 in the next 9 months, I've got something to worry about there. Anyway, the real reason I called was the photos and the message that it kind of sends abroad.
Mm-hmm.
I was watching C-SPAN, and I think it was, I don't even know who it was that was speaking, but somebody pointed out that they're a shame-based society there. Our Muslim friends in the Middle East, they're a shame-based society as opposed to a guilt-based society like we are here.
Right, that's true with a lot of societies, yeah. Guilt sucks.
There's a lot of folks, a lot of these guys who, you know, of course, some of them were just in the wrong place at the wrong time, didn't necessarily even do anything wrong, and you know, they're you know, subjected to this kind of abuse, and it's, I mean, the torture comes once they re-enter their society and have to face the shame that's been inflicted on them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of them are saying, you know, we got to leave Iraq because, you know, of the shame, you know, of being naked in front of other men and women that are not my wife and stuff. I mean, if America's afraid of Muslims, they have every reason to be right now, because we've got a dirty clock, you know, and someone's about to clean it.
Well, you know, you were mentioning about questioning prisoners, and we're talking about that. Now, if you are captured on the battlefield, you remember from World War II movies, what are you required to say? What are you required to give? Remember?
Your name, rank, and serial number.
Name, rank, and serial number. Everybody knows that.
Mm-hmm.
So what is up with this torturing people for information? Now, I'm just looking at this article called "The Commander of the Coalition Prisons Apologizes." Once you get caught, I mean, obviously he knew this was all going on. He said, well, I'm really sorry, you know, if we made people uncomfortable. That this new General Miller, who was running Guantanamo, where all this coercion took place, he's now going to be the new head of what's going on there. He said he has reviewed the U.S. Army's interrogation manual's list of 53 techniques for questioning prisoners. I mean, this is pretty scary. I mean, can you imagine that if we found out that some group that held American prisoners had 53 techniques of interrogating prisoners? You know, the reason for these Geneva Convention rules and international rules of how people are treated isn't just for, you know, to be humane. It's also to kind of get one's own soldiers out of harm's way. Because if we're torturing prisoners, well, then, hell, they'll torture our prisoners. So you kind of make an agreement. I mean, making agreements in war, I know, is a little nuts. But the agreement is pretty much made. Look, you don't. We get name, rank, and serial number from your prisoners. You get name, rank, and serial number from our prisoners. Yet when they put like our prisoners on television, you know, we're like, oh, this is the, you know, this is ghastly. This is a violation of this and that. But there are 53 techniques for questioning. And think that if they suspect that you are part of a militia, that you're part of Al Qaeda, that if you're whatever, they suspect it. And maybe what happened is someone finked on you because they didn't like you. I mean, that's a lot of these people got picked up in these dragnets and these sweeps, and sometimes that they were they wound up in these horrible Saddam jails run by the U.S. because they got a tip. So these 53 techniques are being used on them. They're keeping people up without sleep. They say forced to sit in an uncomfortable position. That would constitute torture, as far as I'm concerned. You're making someone, you're inflicting pain on somebody until they do or say what you want. This is why the United States under George W. Bush has fought so hard not to have the United States be part of the International Court of Justice, because there is war crime after war crime after war crime being committed, and at the top of all this sits Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney and George W. Bush.
Currently. Can I pick up on that, on the 53?
Sure.
We're learning these torture techniques from some people that pretty much have a pretty good grasp on the concept, and it's, you know, it's not just the guy from Guantanamo Bay that's being shipped in there that this is kind of his specialty. We're kind of picking up a lot of tips from our buddies over there in Israel as far as all this goes. And then when we talk about putting the shoe on the other foot, where, you know, if they captured some of our soldiers, well, if they suspected that one of our soldiers was kind of maybe working for the Mossad, maybe, well, you know, how do you think they were going to be treated?
Yeah, well, I mean, we've found out that the ones that have been in captivity, like this Thomas Hamill, wasn't treated very badly at all. So who's got the humanity? That's what we could ask. All right, thank you very much. The current issue... Actually, it's May-June 2004, Mother Jones, interesting magazine, highly recommended. MotherJones.com is, you can see it online. They have Stats of the Union. You know, we have the State of the Union. This is Stats of the Union, Facts, Figures, and Uniquely American Absurdities. Halliburton has 15,000 workers in Iraq and Kuwait, 4,000 more than the number of British soldiers deployed there. And guess who's paying the salary? That's right. Just look at your paycheck and you'll know who is.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby on 101 WRIF Detroit. Our number, 313-298-WRIF. Peter will be back to take more of your calls right after this.
Next, an announcement from President Beer's candidate Miller, already in progress.
And when you, the people, vote for Miller Lite, you can rest assured that you're voting for a beer that has half the carbs of Bud Light. What? No, hey! Stop! I've got more! Thank you. I also have to say that when you vote for Miller Lite, you're voting for a beer with a full one-third less carbs than Coors Light. Yes! No, not yet! Stop! Come on, did I give a signal? No, I didn't. I haven't even told them that Miller Lite has fewer calories than both. Stop! I have 5 solid minutes about how great Miller Lite tastes. Now stop it! That's an order. I'm warning you. Right, okay, you're fired. The band leaves now. Trombone guy out. Drummer, go. Don't play as you leave. Stop!
Vote for great taste at VoteMillerBeer.com. Miller, good call. Based on a 12-ounce serving, Miller Lite has 3.2 grams of carbs, 96 calories. Bud Light has 6.6 grams of carbs, 110 calories. Coors Light has 5 grams of carbs, 102 calories. Miller Brewing Company, Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
You want Michael Lobby Center, the ultimate recreational superstore.
It's time to take your family on the road and travel like a rock star. Hi, Christine Michael here for Walt Michaels RV Center in Belleville. We've all been to concerts and have been amazed at the luxury motor coaches these rock stars travel in. Well, Walt Michaels is making it affordable for you and your family to travel like a rock star, too. And you won't even have to get on stage. So get out and see America in a 37-foot Paysero with dual slide-outs for as low as $679 a month. Pull up to your next concert, football game, or NASCAR event in a luxurious motorhome from Walt Michaels RV Center in Belleville. You'll be the envy of everyone around. Come and see Michigan's largest selection of luxury motorhomes at our indoor showroom on Walt Michaels RV Mile in Belleville. You'll be amazed at how affordable it is to travel like a rock star. Give us a call at 800-697-2500. We'll be looking for you.
This is another Riff Rock concert.
Just when you thought the party was cooling down, it's about to get hotter than hell. GH1 Plastic presents Rock the Nation Tour 2004. The Best is back with more pyro, more thunder, more explosion. Same night, same stage. You also get Poison. June 30th at DTE Energy Music Center. New show, new stage, and bringing you surprises from the entire KISS catalog. It'll take you back and bring you back again, as only KISS can. Together with Poison.
Tickets are on sale now at cc.com, palacenet.com, the Palace Box Office, and all Ticketmaster outlets. Charge at 248-645-6666. Presented by Miller Genuine Brand.
Stick around. More Night Call with Peter Werby. Coming up next.
Catch that cruise in Fort Lauderdale. Take over the theme parks in Orlando. Or hit Tampa with a vengeance. You don't need to wait for a sale. AirTran Airways in Flynn has low airfares year-round to 45 of your favorite destinations. One-way, non-stop flights to Orlando start at just $107. Tampa and Fort Lauderdale start at $115. On Saturdays, fly non-stop to Fort Lauderdale. Leave Flint at 10:58 a.m. You get to sleep in and still get to Fort Lauderdale right at hotel check-in times. No waiting around for a clean room. That's the best timing of any nonstop flight in the region. But there's more. Las Vegas starts at $137, Atlanta $104, and Dallas-Fort Worth is just $130. Why wait for a sale when you really want to go now?
AirTran Airways, go. There's nothing stopping you. Fly nonstop from Flint to Atlanta, Orlando, and Fort Lauderdale, or connect to any of AirTran Airways' 45 destinations. For reservations, go to airtran.com, call your local travel agent, or 1-800-AIRTRAN. Flint's Bishop International Airport. You can get there from here.
Double bogey? Bad. Double eagle? Good. Double parking? Bad. Double dating? Good. Double talk? Hello, buzzer guy. Bad. Double millions? Awesome. Double Millions is the new instant game from the Michigan Lottery with the largest top prize, $2 million. The most ways to win, 24. And the best overall odds of any instant ticket. So win on the double with Double Millions, new from the Michigan Lottery.
Instant games. It's how fun is done.
My husband, Rob, has his own special way of communicating. That's Rob saying he's excited about the new Harley-Davidson Instant Game from the Michigan Lottery. That's right, honey. You could win up to $50,000 cash. They're giving away Harley-Davidson Heritage Soft Shell Classic motorcycles, too. And if you send in 2 non-winning tickets, you're entered to win bonus drawings of a motorcycle or super cool Harley-Davidson merchandise. And if he wins, he'll watch the kids while I spend a week at the spa.
Instant games. It's how fun is
that. Hello again. It's me, your mind. I know what you're thinking. Well, of course, you know I know what you're thinking on your mind. You're thinking I'm going to ditch you at some point this afternoon. Kind of like when I let you disconnect your boss's conference call the other day. Oops. But the Dunkin' Donuts mocha swirl iced latte will change all that. Seriously. Anytime I start getting away from you, all you got to do is take a couple of sips of that invigorating real espresso and milk over ice, and I am all yours again. Oh, come on, let's face it. Most days, iced latte is about the only thing refreshing enough to keep me focused, right? And all that delicious whipped cream and sweet mocha drizzle? Well, how can't we think about that all day? I mean, I'm thinking of it now. But I guess you already knew that, didn't you?
Keep your mind from wandering with the drink that brings you back. Delicious, refreshing Dunkin' Donuts iced latte. Available in original caramel swirl and mocha swirl.
101 WRIF Detroit. Call in with your comments at 313-298-WRIF. Now, Night Call returns. Here's Peter Werby.
Okay, thank you very much. Welcome back. We're talking about the miserable situation that George W. Bush and his cronies, Bush Co., we can call them when they're all put together, because they're just in there to loot the American people, send it all to their corporate buddies. In the meantime, their dreams of an imperial outpost in the Middle East has just gone to hell, hasn't it? And bringing how many of us with it? Our troops, their people. Joe writes into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Peter, I have a question for you. Where's all the money going from the oil? Didn't we save them? Well, did we? Doesn't look like we're saving them now. It looks like we're fighting them. Or free their people from Saddam. Why aren't they footing the bill? Being that Saddam is no longer in power, where's all the oil money going? Well, it just isn't there. It's not producing the money. That was another one of the Bushco lies that Rumsfeld put forth. I think he's probably out of there, hopefully, at least. But, you know, the money was generated from oil production was going to pay for it all. Instead, you and I, are, Joe, and the rest of us are paying for it. In the meantime, they keep nickel and diming us. Bushco does, except it's in the tens of billions. And now Bush wants this, another $25 billion for the Iraqi war. Again, pick up your local paper. Look at your local newspaper. You know, I think we got a lot of them are... You know, just these, what am I trying to say? Not the news in the Free Press, but those are, sometimes you can see these stories as well. But these ones that are just in your local area, in your neighborhood or something like that, and see what's happening. I mean, I look a little kind of middle-class community like Ferndale, and they're like $1 million, they got $1 million deficit. So what we expect a return on our taxes. We don't expect it to go to Halliburton and the Carlyle Group and Bechtel and all of Bush's buddies to destroy Iraq and then rebuild it. Now, the Bush administration has asked Congress for a $25 billion down payment on next year's U.S. operations in Iraq and Afghanistan, a retreat from the White House's earlier plans not to seek money until after the November elections. Because, again, it's never about policy. It's never about being upfront with the American people. It's how is this going to play? How is this going to affect the elections? So they want an advance on the allowance from us. So we're footing the bill. Now, on the other hand, John Kerry, somebody who rarely gets mentioned on this show, pledged to channel $30 billion over 10 years to improve teacher pay as well as raise teaching standards. So this is our choice. We can take $30 billion and increase the quality of our schools and reward the people who are teaching our children, who are preparing the next generation. Or we can go the Bushco route, take another $25 billion, stuff it down the rat hole of his corporate buddies, and we can put our kids in classrooms with 40 students. You tell me, which do you want? 313-298-WRIF, and on the internet or email, calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Hi, it's Night Call. Thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
How you doing, Peter? My name's Greg from Taylor.
Hi, Greg.
I was listening to you earlier, and basically what you were saying was be a little bit more skeptic the way you view Bush's, you know, what he's doing or whatever.
Right.
Well, this is you know, what I understand of it is basically Bush is in the power of the most powerful corporation in the world, and that's the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Now you're going to tell me that a man in charge of so much power, and he's got all this money to work with, and he's going to feed whatever pockets he wants to feed, and you're going to tell me he's not going to get some of that money back from them pockets that he's feeding? You know what, man? I am so daggone tired of this. You know, people not understanding. What, you know, I mean, it's right in front of their face.
Well, there's an old saying that they say, always behind your back, but, how's it go? I mean, always behind your back, but always in front of your, right in front of your face. So it's both, really. I mean, the most underhanded deals are going on that don't ever even make it to the newspapers or to the nightly news.
How much proof do you need?
Yeah, well, I know. You know, one thing, I'll tell you, Greg, I didn't think I really, as I so often do, because I'm so damn ADD, finished entirely my thought. I said that when Bush speaks, I assume he's lying. And I meant to say, if that sounds too partisan or too cynical, that maybe what we ought to do with all politicians, I mean, I wasn't any different when Gore or Clinton was in office. I mean, I didn't think everything they said was a lie the way it was Bush. But when a politician says something, I go into neutral. I think, you know, I start thinking. I mean, I don't believe him at face value. I don't believe that, you know, that he's saying anything other than to create an effect. that he's not committed to the truth. I mean, some are more than others. And, of course, Bushko is, institutionalized prevarication. I mean, they wouldn't tell the truth if that was the easiest way to go. They were afraid they'd get out of the habit of lying. But in any event, I think that if anyone can take at face value the utterances of powerful politicians, particularly ones when it's quite clear that they're acting at the behest of the huge financial interests that ultimately run this society, that they're just really saps waiting to have their pockets picked.
I'm not skeptical. Just I look at all the politicians also, and I see what Clinton done when he basically he got the high taxes. He had the high taxes going. Okay, so we had all this surplus of money that he built up in 8 years' time,
mm-hmm.
and then what did he do? Instead of doing something like put it back into Social Security, like they ripped it off in the first place for Social Security in Reagan's era. And instead of paying that money back, which that's exactly what they should have done, or either, take care of whatever debt we had. No, what do? They turn around and give it to Bush's hand. Bush says, well, I'm going to go back 1 year, and we're going to pay back money depending on, the amount of money you might have done in this 1 year time. But it took 8 years to put that surplus in there. And guess what? Say I wasn't working
mm-hmm.
good that year. Well, guess what? And actually, a lot of people weren't working good that year. The corporations were still making their money. They still got theirs. They still put that in there.
Sure.
The corporations are the one that end up getting the money out of that deal. You know what? I didn't get a dime.
Well, you're not untypical. I mean, that's the way that the Bush line went out on that. It said that the average person's going to get all this money. Well, the average person doesn't get squat. I mean, the average the person making over $200,000 is the people that really made out. I was mentioning earlier that there were these stats of the union, and one of them, the cost of the Bush tax cuts this year alone is enough to give $93,000 to each of the 3 million people who've lost their jobs since Bush took office. All right, thank you very much, Greg. Appreciate your call. Thanks for joining us at 313-298-WRIF. Hi, it's Night Call. You're on the air. Good evening.
Hello. I was wondering if
whoa.
The real problem is they let the homosexuals in the military. They got guys taking pictures of people's rear ends.
What do you think that the problem is that they let homosexuals in the military?
Yeah.
I've got time for this. Thanks, though. 313-298-WRIF. Actually, I would have gone on with the quality. What you think that, Jay, you think that was something that I was doing? You wanted me to turn down something. His radio. Oh, it was his radio doing it. Oh, I see. All right. Jay Hudson, by the way, is our producer and phone screener, and ably assisted by Dan Letarski as well. So thank you, guys. You didn't get the proper credit. Just wait till we move into our new studios, guys, and there's nobody on line four. There is, line four looks empty. Hello. I told you it was empty. All right, you want me to go to line five? That's empty. I'm looking at it. Come on, guys. Whoa, what happened? Did everybody get blown off? All right, 313-298-WRIF. You've been trying to get on. There is suddenly plenty of room. How about line six? You guys going to give me a call, or you want me to talk a little more? No, I want calls. I've been on the line for so long. Here's another statistic. Without Social Security, half of senior citizens would live in poverty. One in every 115 Americans work for Walmart. What about that? You got, all right. Hi, WRIF, and you're on the air. Good evening.
Warby, how you doing?
Doing well.
I got a few questions for you.
Sure.
I'm a young 23-year-old that lives in Warren, Michigan, and I've been around here my whole entire life, and I've listened to a lot of different political issues that I don't even think that this world can even answer.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to know, in your opinion, any kind of candidate that could possibly lead our country that would take us anywhere that we, as a young generation, and myself included, could honestly say that this elected leader that we're looking for could honestly represent me as a person and everyone else that sees the ideal views that the young people in America actually look at and could say that this leader can look for the interests of education and, like, world peace and try to take us to a world where we know that us young people can honestly sit there and say that we want to live in this world. I mean, I don't think Bush can do this, but my question is, can Kerry even carry this any further as a person, take it any further?
Well, I'll tell you, the best endorsement I've heard of Kerry came from Nader, who said that all he would do would be to slightly stop the deterioration, which isn't much of a recommendation. In fact, that's called damned by faint praise. I'll tell you, there's no one out there that has those qualities that I can think of. Or if they do, I mean, there's tons of people out there that do. But as long as you have an electoral system that's dependent upon tens of millions of dollars coming from corporate interests, you're never going to get anybody in there that's going to do anything more than just slightly tinker with what is. And a lot more is necessary, as you are so ably indicating.
I got another question for you.
Sure.
A new NPR public-related issue that I've heard about recently is publicly funded elections. Now, this is something that I heard a very interesting, very enlightening conversation on, and it was saying how publicly funded candidates are coming up in Arizona, and these publicly funded people are stepping forward and trying to run for office outside of privately funded people, or I should say candidates.
Mm-hmm.
And as a person, like, let's say that I wanted to run for office, I know absolutely no one in the entire world that would honestly step up to me and say, you know what, you're a young candidate, you have great options and great ideas and great ideals that this society should look towards. I mean, I don't even see Michigan even stepping up and saying that this should be even an option. But, like, do you think that any president candidate or presidential candidacy in the next 10 years would even consider even trying to find a publicly funded system?
No, it's too convenient. The current system where they have huge donors, which either directly at worst or indirectly at best expect a return on their investment. So when, you know, George Bush is getting, what is he up to now, $130, $140 million, these big corporations are expecting that he's going to institute regulations and legislation that will pay them back so that the few million they may have donated will wind up to be tens of millions of dollars extra in profit by not enforcing environmental laws or labor laws or something along the lines like that. Look, I don't think, or maybe you've even seen this bumper sticker that says, if the people lead, the leaders will follow. And left now to their own devices of either parties, I mean, it used to be that they were almost equally bad. Now the Republican Party has gotten so awful, is so dangerous, and to have George W. Bush and these gangsters rewarded with another term in the White House would be catastrophic for this nation and probably the world as well. So there's good reason to get rid of George W. Bush, but replacing him with Mr. Nobody isn't going to change very much along the lines. And what ultimately has to be done, and what will change things, is a mass movement of citizens. And that mass movement isn't here. I don't know how to call it into being. It comes along every once in a while in American history to completely alter the nature of our society, and we need one badly.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby on 101 WRIF Detroit. Our number, 313-298-WRIF. Peter will be back to take more of your calls right after this.
Woohoo! I'm the man! Who wants me to want them? Woohoo!
Hold on, Tiger.
Hello?
Looks like you're enjoying a Captain Morgan's Parrot Bay Breeze.
Yeah, but I'd rather be enjoying you.
Settle down, corn dog.
Don't mind if I do.
And remember, slurring is not considered a sexy foreign accent.
Oui, oui.
Stumbling will never become the latest dance craze.
Really?
Tall, loud, and obnoxious is nobody's type.
Really?
And nobody wants to gaze into bloodshot eyes.
Oh.
In other words,
cut myself off before I start acting like an idiot.
That's right. Because common sense is the most important sense of all.
all.
Can I buy you a glass of water, maybe?
Now you're talking. Captain Morgan's Parrot Bay Coconut Flavored Rum. The rum capital of the world is closer than you think. It's in your glass whenever you pour a Puerto Rican rum. Only the finest rums come from Puerto Rico.
Puerto Rican rum with natural coconut flavor. 21 to 24% alcohol by volume. Captain Morgan Rum Company. Drink responsibly. Captain's orders.
Do you want some water?
You're scaring me.
Oh, yeah. Sorry.
Kids, eat your vegetables.
Why?
Because they have vitamins that are good for you. Kids, go outside and play.
Why?
Because fresh air is good for you.
Parents are always telling kids why something's good for them.
Kids, time for bed.
Why?
Because sleeping is good for you.
So don't be surprised when they start telling you.
Mom, don't smoke anymore.
Why?
Because it's not good for us.
Protect your children from secondhand smoke. If you or someone you know smokes, ask them to take it outside. Secondhand smoke can cause bronchitis, pneumonia, ear infections, and asthma in children. So if you're a smoker, don't smoke around people you love. Better yet, quit. Just call 1-800-537-5666 for more information. That's 1-800-537-5666. A message from the Michigan Department of Community Health and the Michigan Association of Broadcasters.
More Night Call with Peter Worthy, next on The Rim.
Looks like there's some kind of overturned meat truck up ahead. And of course, everyone stops to look. Yes, let's all look at the meat. This, my friend, is time you will not get back. Make up for lost time. Every Nextel phone has a built-in walkie-talkie, so things get done faster. Sign up now and get 10,000 minutes a month. That's 4,000 walkie-talkie minutes, 1,000 anytime minutes, and 5,000 night and weekend minutes, long distance included. All for just $54.99 a month. Trade up to Nextel. Call 800-NEXTEL-9, go to Nextel.com, or visit a store near you. Nextel. Done. Offer ends May 31st, 2004. Two-year agreement required. $200 early termination, account setup fees, taxes, charges, and other restrictions apply. Phones by Motorola. Legal disclaimer? Done.
Sign up by May 31st and save $175 on the i730 with color screen and speakerphone. Now only $124.99 with $25 invoice credit and two-year service agreement.
The Motor City's best rock station, 101 WRIF, and the best radio website in the world, WRIF.com, brings the hottest deals in the Motor City. Now WRIF.com makes your night on the town even better without hitting your wallet with Dine Online. You are now one click away from dining at some of your favorite restaurants for only half price.
Dine Online and eat for less with WRIF.com.
Save a ton of money with some of Metro Detroit's premier restaurants.
Like 10 East Street Roadhouse, located on West Village Drive in the heart of West Dearborn, featuring great American food and great American music. You can purchase full-price gift certificates to area restaurants for only half price.
But quantities are limited, so hurry and order your half-price certificates now.
Dine Online.
It's all from the station that delivers you more.
101 The Riff.
101 WRIF gives you the best deals in Detroit at WRIF. Check out special offers and savings from Motor City businesses.
Like Dr. Roche, put your best face and body forward with help from Dr. Roche.
Log on today and save.
With the home of rock and roll
at WRIF.com. This is Night Call. This is Night Call. The Riff Podium Talk Show. Now, here's Peter Worby.
Thank you very much. WRIF Detroit is where we're broadcasting from, and welcome to all of you, and to many of you listening on the Internet around the country and around the world. You can hear archive shows at radiopower.org and whiterosesociety.org. Radiopower.org replays this program tomorrow, Monday. You can go to their website for the schedules. We're talking about the new photos that have come out of this prison abuse in Iraq that are so widespread that they may have been essentially the straw that broke the camel's back. A number of people, from Republican senators to ex-generals, have saying the United States has lost the war. Isn't it time to get out? I mean, shouldn't we just impeach all these guys in the White House that got us into this mess in the first place? I mean, think about this. They impeached Bill Clinton, you know, brought him to trial. That's what impeachment is. Because he lied about, not having sex with an intern. I mean, and yet Bush and them can lie about this war that has resulted in tens of thousands of deaths, tens of thousands more of wounded people on both sides. given away our country's fortune, and he still sits up there saying, I'm just so sorry that this happened. You know, they're going to try Saddam Hussein. Let me see if I can find this real quickly. This is absolutely astounding. Let's see if I can find this. Oh, how about this? This is Paul Bremer. He says, there is no room in the new Iraq for the kind of lawless, self-interested behavior we have seen over recent weeks. No individual is above the law. No group is beyond the law. He's talking about, of course, these militias that have rose up in resistance to the United States occupation. So he's saying this, there's no individuals above the law. And this is from, the Coalition Provisional Authority website. So this is, you know, Bremer's website. As he made this observation, Bremer named Adnan al-Sarufi as the new governor of Najaf. So here is this American who was appointed the administrator of Iraq by who? By the invading United States Army that had the authority to do that, because, you know, so what are we talking about here? Who has more authority in Iraq? These Muslim Shiite militias who are made up of the people that live there, or Paul Bremer from Connecticut, who comes in there in his blue suit and work boots and starts appointing people that satisfy him? We got to get out of there, folks. We got to get out of there. The lives of our children and relatives and neighbors, the Iraqi people, they don't deserve this. They want to have a Shiite republic or a Shiite dictatorship. I guess they're going to have to deal with that. It's not my favorite form of government. But, this is, it's only going to get worse. And the photographs that are coming out are only going to get worse. The one that's come out now is this horrible shot of U.S. soldiers sicking snarling German shepherds on a terrified, naked Iraqi. And then the next photo shows him not only bleeding profusely from the dog bites, but also there is an American soldier sitting on him. Support our troops. 313-298-WRIF. By the way, at 1 a.m. Eastern Time coming up, you can hear my interview with Paul Rykoff. Paul Rykoff is a returning Iraq vet. He can tell you about his experiences. He didn't see any of that, by the way, but he has some interesting opinions. And also, then I guess it would be about 1:30, Andrei Codrescu, the NPR commentator, the one from Transylvania, you know him? So he told me he doesn't sleep much. When you're from Transylvania, you don't have to. Okay, let's come back. Let's go back to our phones. Hi, WRIF, and you're on the air. Good evening.
Hi, Peter.
Hi.
I just wanted to start by saying that I think that June 30th seems like the right day to start the impeachment of George W. Bush, don't you?
Yeah, well, I don't know. What is actually going to happen? They say they're going to turn the government over to the Iraqis? Who?
Yeah, I don't know. They don't seem to have anybody in place yet.
No, but, they don't have much of a plan, do they?
Yeah, no, it doesn't seem like it. They seem to just thought only as far as getting in there and then nothing about what they're going to do once they get there. But I was going to say, right-wing talk show guys are saying, it doesn't really matter if we look at it as like it's no worse than a fraternity hazing, because what really matters is, how the Iraqis see it and the other Arabs see it. And, how many people are going to, join their cause, the worst kind. Not that all of them are in that cause, but, and then also, everything we've done in Iraq has only led to generating more hate among everybody in the world, not only Iraq and the Arabs, but, people in Europe hate us. I mean, everything George W. Bush has done has just turned everything around. That we had this great goodwill after 9/11, and it's all just totally been, reversed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right. I just can't imagine that the American people would, they didn't elect him in the first place, so I can't say re-elect, but would give him another shot at all this. I mean, if someone said to me, do you have any sense of what's going to happen in the next few weeks, the next few months? I would say, I can't even imagine, but I can't imagine it being anything but worse. Because You know, all throughout the business lives and political lives of the Bush and Cheney and Rumsfeld, they've made mistake after mistake after mistake that has cost this government, all through the Nixon and Reagan and Bush 1 regimes, all of those. The terrible errors that they make, and they never have to pay for it. The people of Central America wind up paying for it. The people in the Middle East do it, the investors in their companies, but they never have to bear the cost of the responsibility. And now, because they're never going to say, look, we've made a mistake, we're going to change policy. I mean, I guess someone told me, it'll sound real good if you apologize to the king and say, we're sorry what we did in Iraq.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah,
we'll see. All right, thank you.
Oh, I just wanted to say, I guess that means that a vast accumulation of wealth can buy you success even if you're a failure.
You're right.
All right.
Thank you.
Thanks, Peter.
Sure. Thanks for calling in. 313-298-WRIF. Oh, yeah, this is from Don. He sent this in from La Crosse, Wisconsin. Now, one of the things, actually, I always get the feeling that there's a lot of you that know exactly what I'm talking about because you are as conversant as I am in all this. You know some part of the I don't know if it's a puzzle. You know some piece of all this. I know some piece. I guess my duty is kind of enunciate it publicly. But like I've said a few shows ago, you're not ditto heads. You're not a pack of dopes that have no idea and are just waiting for the talk show host to fill your head with the arguments you can give against reality. Because the reality of this situation is these horrific photographs, and the authoritarian conservatives doesn't know what to make of it because these are awful. I know these are awful. This makes us look real bad. Then you listen to Rushbo, and he tells you why it's not so bad. It's like fraternity hazing, and these people tried to kill you, so it's okay anyways, and they were just letting off steam and having fun. That's what he said. He said they were just having fun, these Americans who were sicking dogs on people and stacking them in pyramids. Anyways, but then there's some of you who are listening and don't know anything about all of this and are kind of you just go off the headlines that you might hear on Foxhole News or something like that. So if I say Ahmed Chalabi, Chalabi, you wouldn't know who Chalabi was. Ahmed Chalabi, probably a lot of you don't know who it is. But here's who he was. He's head of the Iraqi National Congress. He's the guy that fed the United States all this phony information about weapons of mass destruction. I mean, anybody with any brains like me and most of you knew that it was still BS. But this allowed Rumsfeld to say, well, we got these reports. Anyways, he's a gangster. He's been convicted in absentia in Jordan of bank fraud, and he is the favored politician to rule Iraq. I mean, we moved in there because it's an undemocratic country, and then we appoint the czar, essentially, Paul Bremer, and then he and whoever is going to appoint this Ahmed Chalabi or somebody from his group. Anyways, as you may know, Saddam Hussein is being held captive, and he's going to be tried for crimes. And this guy committed a lot of crimes. So there ought to be some way of reckoning. But I don't know if this is exactly going about it the right way. Ahmed Chalabi's nephew, Salem. Now get this. Chalabi is this gangster that has been the recipient of millions of dollars over the last 10 years of our tax dollars. But his nephew, Salem, has been put in charge of the trial of Saddam Hussein. Okay, so that's kind of weird to begin with. The arch political rival of the person he hopes to replace, the cousin, turns out to be the guy who's in charge of the trial. Now, Salem Chalabi is a partner in Zell and Feith, a Jerusalem-based law firm headed by a West Bank settler in which Douglas Feith, the U.S. Undersecretary of Defense for Planning, is also a senior partner when not in the U.S. government. Now, this is one of those things you might think, what? I didn't get this. I couldn't follow all that. And what the hell does that have to do with anything? And who is Douglas Feith? Douglas Feith is another one of these people, along with Wolfowitz and who are these? All of a sudden, I'm forgetting all these characters that pushed this war, that said we could do this easily, that will reconfigure the Middle East, that the people there will welcome us with open arms. This is Douglas Feith. Now, the guy that's head of going to take charge of the trial of Saddam Hussein is the nephew of the man who aspires to be the head of Iraq. And the man who's doing it, Salem, is a partner in one of the neocon members who of a law firm in Jerusalem, who's the Undersecretary of Defense for Planning. I mean, here's maybe you can't follow. I'm not even sure I can follow. But you know what? We're being run not by a government, but by a racket. This is a crime family that has us in its claw. Let's see. You can be assured that the trial will be conducted on behalf of the Bush administration and the neocons and on behalf of the Chalabis. Since the Chalabis have been trying to overthrow Saddam for decades, it's hard to see how this can even have the appearance of an impartial trial. So here you have this murderous dictator, of course, supplied and supported for years by people like Ronald Reagan and George Bush the First, and he's going to be able to say, hey, look, this is rigged. Look who is running this. All right, let's go back to our phones. 313-298-WRIF. I'm Peter Werby. Hi, it's Night Call. You're on the air. Good evening.
Hi, Peter. How are you?
Doing well.
I have a few comments here on, you know, Wolfowitz is correct when he said that we would, you know, go in there easily and, you know, destroy the Iraqis. Now, I fought over there in the Iraq War during last year this time. And mm-hmm. We did. We went over there with one division and we just bowled them over.
Sure.
But what they failed to see was that, you know, building up a country that has nothing, from zero to nothing, is impossible. With Germany and Japan, when we did it in World War II, Japan and Germany already had a, you know, an industrial engine that was ready to be primed and ready to go. Iraq has had nothing for how many years?
Right.
They don't know what to do with freedom and money and prosperity. They've never had it.
They didn't have prosperity.
You can't give a teenager $1 million and expect them to do right with it.
Now, they were one of the most prosperous countries in the world up till in the Middle East up till 1991.
Right, but that was just a select few. That was the upper echelon of the Iraq people.
No. One of the things a dictator did was to, you know, spread around. A lot of those religious dictatorships that are our pals over there, they figured the way they can keep people happy is to spread it around. But then, with the war, the first war and the sanctions, it just, everything went to hell. But listen, I think people are probably more interested to, if you were over there, give us a little picture of what you saw, and I don't mean with, you know, abuse or anything, but what were your experiences there? It's pretty hard to sum up, I'm sure, in a short phone call, but give us a shot.
Well, what I saw was, they did welcome us. They were happy to see it. You know, when we came into, I fought at Basra when we took al-Basra, and, you know, they were happy to see the American troops come in, and, you know, they were waving their arms and clapping, and the longer I stayed, the more they seemed to hate us. I mean, I don't know what we were doing over there for them to hate us as much as they did, but things went downhill almost as soon as we finished bowling over the Iraqi Republic Guard.
Well, I mean, I don't know. You were there, but I mean, everything I've read was that, or I mean, if you think about it, common sense, you'd think, it would be like if, for instance, the Americans would have occupied France for a long time after World War II. I mean, everybody was damn glad, for the U.S. to kick Hitler out of France, right? But then we immediately turned it over to them.
Right, and I mean, maybe that's what they don't like seeing is, I mean, I know that, you know, I wouldn't like seeing foreign tanks on my city streets, you know, breaking down doors if I'm just trying to, you know, go to work and, you know, pay my bills and, you know, feed my kids, and I'm not doing anything wrong. I know that would, you know, I don't know. I don't know what we did over there. I didn't see any abuse, and I didn't see anything like that. I saw a lot of soldiers acting appropriately.
Mm-hmm. And, well, I think probably most soldiers did.
Yeah, I mean, that's all I saw over there.
But what's happening now? How long since you've been there?
I came back in June of last year.
Oh, well, now, of course, you're in a way in the same position I am, is just reading in the news. I mean, there's just a full-scale battles going on of urban warfare.
Yeah, that's what I hear.
And actually what these, I've got two of my papers are too messed up here, but one of the generals said that the only way we're going to be able to win is to inflict such damage on the society and destroy so much of the cities and towns and kill so many people that we're going to, you know, as our military victories increase, as you were experiencing, the hatred for us is going to increase, not only in Iraq, but throughout the Middle East.
Yeah, I just don't see, I just see it heading south. I mean, I see it getting, you know, I see Vietnam.
Yeah.
That's all I see. I see just Vietnam. I see guys coming home with really, you know, post-traumatic stress where they're getting flashbacks, and that's all I see. I see history repeating itself. I mean, hell, Bush dodged Vietnam. He's doomed to repeat it, it seems like.
That's interesting, yeah. Well, welcome back in one piece. At some point, though, it happened during the Vietnam era, that guys started thinking, wait a minute, am I going to be the last guy wounded or killed for this? And then the morale of the fighting man just begins to erode, and that's what happened in Vietnam.
Yeah, I don't know how the Joes are feeling over there now, but that's probably what's going to go on. Years, you know, they're going to start drafting people, or they're going to start recalling, guys that have been out for 3 or 4 years, and you're not going to see people over that want to be there.
Mm-hmm. Well, you might be interested. I don't know what your schedule is for the rest of the night. I know it's getting kind of late, but at 1 a.m. I'm going to be playing an interview I did with an Iraq vet who got back, I think, in February of this year. So you might be interested in that.
Yeah, I would definitely be interested in listening to it.
All right, thank you so much.
Well, Peter, I actually did have another question.
Sure.
I've heard rumors about Bush wanting to cut overtime, making it optional for companies to pay their employees overtime.
No, it's not optional, but what they would, at the behest of his wealthy pals, he wants to cut back the number of people that would be eligible, and that particularly, I think, it's white-collar workers that, I mean, as it is, most white-collar workers work more than 40 hours, but it would, it would significantly harm the overtime of whole categories of employees. I don't have it at all right at my fingertips, which I should have everything at my fingertips, right?
I'm middle management for an automotive supplier, and I tell you, if they cut overtime, they'd kill me. I'd have to sell my house.
Well, I hate to tell you, but you're the ones that are in the gun sites. They can't do much with the hourly wages and union contracts and what have you, but a lot of it is aimed at the middle class. I don't even understand this. I mean, wouldn't you think that he would be trying to cultivate middle class people to support them? I don't get it.
I mean, that's what I would think. I mean, that seems to be where all the a lot of people in the automotive, they're real Republicans, and when I hear him support Bush, I say, well, he wants to cut overtime, and that's how a lot of us live. I mean, they don't pay us all that great as a supplier, but we make up for it in our overtime.
Yeah, that's terrible. I mean, it's terrible that you have to do that and don't have either the leisure or family time available. I was saying last week that over 120 years ago, people were shot down in the streets of Chicago demonstrating for the eight-hour day, and we haven't gotten anywhere since. I mean, why? In the 1950s, the labor unions, or at least some sectors of them, put forth the idea that there ought to be 30 hour week and a 40 hour pay. In other words, that the productivity of the American worker had increased such that we ought to be able to work less. And productivity has increased tremendously over the last generation. That's why there's been so much wealth created among the top 10% and 5%, and particularly the top 1%, but they have not shared it one little bit.
And they never will.
Well, they never will. They never will if we ask them. I don't mean that we should take it, but I mean, if there's, you can structure legislation so that it, that's the law. In other words, if you had a minimum wage of $10 or $12 an hour, for instance, that would be the base pay. So you wouldn't, that's what the people at McDonald's would get, $10 or $12 an hour. So if you were a middle manager like you, you would say, well, hey, I should be getting $18, $20 an hour. And
as a matter of fact, well, Peter, I'm the lowest paid person in my plant. Actually, the union make more than I do. A basic low-end union assembler makes more money than I do, and I went to college for 4 years.
Hmm. Yeah.
I mean, that's just, they, the companies do, they bring in young people, pay them less, and move out the old people.
Well, that's
management
what,
has no union to for seniority.
That's right. And, you know, at one point, people always thought, and it was in the 50s that I think it began to erode with our parents or grandparents, where people always had the idea that we were going to eliminate poverty. In fact, you know, now poverty is growing, job loss is increasing, and that wages were going to get better and better, and that the time spent at work was going to decrease because this society as a whole got wealthier and wealthier. Except it has, except the people that are producing it all, you and the guys in the shop, you know, aren't getting the rewards that are due you for the kind of work you put in. I mean, why should you have to work 45 and 50 hours a week? It doesn't make
I would like to work 45, 50 hours a week. It seems like I do a lot more.
Well, no. Okay. Well, what I mean is you should be able to, that we all should be able to work like 30 hours a week. I mean, that's why I got into this job, because but, you know, most of us don't have that kind of luxury. And, but what I'm getting at is that a standard work week could be very easily in this country 30 hours. And we could be rewarded much, much more greatly than we are. But they've conspired to greedily put it all in their hands. And you know, asking them nicely, that's what I was starting to say, saying, gee, could you please share a little of your money? They're going to go, no, we want billions and billions and billions, even though they can't do a damn thing with it. It's not like they can get, you know, a ninth house. You know that Donald Rumsfeld has six houses in New Mexico alone?
Yeah, I heard that.
Yeah, so
I heard that.
The point being, and whatever happened to that idea, you know, have you ever see that book, Everything I Know I Learned in Kindergarten? I think, you know, you don't bring candy to class unless you can got some to, you know, share with everyone. And there's enough here for everyone. And I guess the long and the short of what I'm trying to say, as long as we don't have a mass movement for social change, things are just going to, we're just going to have to, you know, hope that they're nice to us.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It definitely seems that way.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate your call. Peter Werbe here with you. 313-298-WRIF is our phone number. Hi, it's Night Call. You're on the air. Good evening. Hey, you with me? Ooh, the sounds of silence. Hi, it's Night Call. You're on the air. Good evening.
Yeah. My name is Philip. Hi. Good evening, Peter.
Hi.
I've been listening to you a few times, first caller. I want to go back to the Iraq war.
Sure.
I myself was involved with the Israeli military in a war in Lebanon in 1982. And this war, in a bigger scale, is very similar. So when Israel went in, invasion, they thought people will celebrate with us. It was very easy to win. After 4 years, they had to run out.
Right.
And here, it's the same. Come on, how can you expect people to get you with flowers? You've been bombing them. Come on. Common sense. They've been in a war, 12 years of embargo. The people suffered. True, under Saddam, they suffered. But they still suffered under the bombing. People that think that a bomb is smart and going to kill only the combatant
mm-hmm.
is bullshit. Come on, sorry. It's bull. Come on. It's not... You know, it's happened, and the people around it suffer it. So they won't bring you with the open arm. Remember, even with the Israelis, they had the Christian army on their side. However, everyone remembers Abraham Shatila. Sharon, that is the prime minister, was one of the generals there.
Right.
So it's like we're surprised of what's going on into the interrogation. But come on, common sense. It is the way it goes. Well, if you're going to have, why the U.S. has what Guantanamo Bay is under the Geneva Convention? Come on, they are enemy combatants. They are not into it. Come on, if Sutter, when Sutter was proclaiming his way against the U.S., we call him a bad guy. But when Bush is calling all the terrorists as thugs, as they don't deserve the Geneva Convention, then he is as much responsible for the action of the people that did what they did.
Well, yeah, I mean, how in the world he gets the authority to declare who is the recipient of standard prisoner of war rights, or even an American citizens, a couple American citizens are denied their rights, is beyond me. and it's also extremely frightening. All right, I got to take my break, so thank you very much. Appreciate your call. By the way, I forgot this. We were talking about the 53 techniques of interrogating prisoners of war. And I said that I thought that all one had to give was name, rank, and serial number. And that's really all that could be demanded. Someone could say, well, how many troops do you have? Where are they moving? Where were you trained? What kind of weaponry do you have? And you'd say, private first class, so-and-so, my serial number is, 1976401. But, let's see, Peter writes in to calltalkyes@yahoo.com. He said, the Geneva Convention does not at all disallow techniques of interrogating prisoners of war. Prisoners of war are indeed allowed to be interrogated. What they do disallow, however, is a list of certain techniques. Clearly, what we have seen so far are disallowed techniques. Well, all of those, yeah. But I'm sure you can't beat people, and beatings were SOP, standard operating procedures at these prisons that the Americans were running. And I mean, so there was great brutality being practiced at Guantanamo in Afghanistan and on a large scale in Iraq. I mean, the International Red Cross said this. The human rights, Bremer's human rights guy told him that. I was looking for some of this stuff here. Can't find it. But how far can you go with this stuff? I mean, can you just say, I'd like to ask you a question, Mr. Prisoner of War, and you say, name, rank, and serial number, and you tell him. And so then what? Can you deprive them of sleep? Can they do that to our guys? In other words, if the Sadr militia captures our soldiers and they want to find out this or that from some young man or woman from Monroe, Michigan, can they then deprive him of sleep for 36 hours? Can they take her and bend her arms back and maybe put a piece of man's underwear over her face as they were doing to naked the way they were doing that to an Iraqi? I mean, is that okay? I mean, I can't believe it. These must all be war crime.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Living with depression can change your quality of life. Depression leaves you feeling sad, irritable, and tired. You lose interest and quit doing the things you used to enjoy, like going to the movies or out for dinner. You feel a loss of connection from your friends and family. You can't seem to motivate yourself to get out and do anything. You may have trouble sleeping. People who are depressed say it's like living life in black and white. If this sounds like you, you are not alone. Over 50 million Americans will suffer from depression sometime during their lifetime. Depression is not a personality problem or weakness. It is a real condition that affects the brain. Dr. Robert Bielski and the Institute for Health Studies are offering an investigational medication research study for depression. If you qualify, you'll receive study medication and all research-related care at no cost to you. For more information, call the Institute for Health Studies toll-free at 1-877-908-CARE. That's 1-877-908-CARE.
The case of home loan applicant Matt Seitz, a young software salesman with nerves of steel.
Compatible? What? I had no idea. Would you just give me a sec to figure it out?
Make that nerves of 10.
Mister, please, fries or onion rings?
Too much pressure.
Make that nerves of dough. You see, lately, Matt was a mess. The tribulation of getting a home loan had frazzled his thinking ability. Then Matt went to Washington Mutual Home Loans. They soothed his concerns with several affordable loan options. Now Matt's back to his suave salesman self.
So, Sharon, what do you say we head back to my new domicile and check out the wine cellar?
Ah! I'll take that as a maybe.
Congratulations, Matt. Homeowner, ladies' man, congratulations. Washington Mutual Home Loans. The power of yes. An equal housing lender.
Call 1-888-WAMU-LEND so you can get into the house without the hassles. That's the power of yes.
We've got a program that fits you perfectly in medical weight loss, shape of things to come.
My name is Edward.
Dr. Benoit. I've lost 114 pounds on a medical weight loss clinic program.
My name is Ramon Dawson. I went from a 44-inch waist to a 33-inch waist. Don't waste another day. The program, it does work.
Imagine having the best summer of your life. You can lose all the weight you want in time for summer for only $1 per pound. Go where Ed, Ramon, and thousands of other men and women have found a way to live a better life. The medical weight loss clinic works one-on-one with you. Team up with a medical weight staff and you can lose all the weight you want for only $1 per pound, without drugs, without frozen food, just a regular grocery store menu and constant support.
Some restrictions may apply.
Call Medical Weight Loss now for your free consultation. Call 1-800-GET-SLIM. That's 1-800-GET-SLIM.
We've got a program that fits you perfectly in medical weight loss, the shape of things to come.
This is WRIF.com. All day Thursday, your walk right in free station, 101 The Rift, unleashes a ticket blitz Thursday. Keep your radio locked on 101 WRIF all day this Thursday
for your chance to hook up with tickets to all of the hottest concerts and events happening around the Motor City.
Hooking you up like no other Detroit station can. Listen for your chance to win.
Then call the Rift request line at 313-298-WRIF.
Don't forget. You can always improve your chances to win by joining the Rift Cyber Crew today and score your totally unfair internet advantage.
Just log on to WRIF.com.
It's Ticket Blitz Thursday on the Rift, all day Thursday from your walk right in free station. 101 The Rift.
Hello.
How are you?
What you missed. From Drew and Mike in the morning.
Howard Dean was over for me when I found out I didn't have cable. I don't know how anybody could not want cable if you can afford it. It just seems that we're so different. I don't see how you can be my president.
Yeah,
I mean, I worry that you'll do stuff that will take away my cable or something, or you don't care about it. You don't care what's on TV,
sure.
And what's on TV is a big part of my life.
Yeah.
I stayed at a resort once, and they didn't have TV. They thought that, people need to be outside here because we have these great grounds and stuff, so they thought they would make that decision for me.
Wow.
I know. I couldn't believe it. I was shocked. I spent the whole vacation in the lounge at the main part of the hotel.
But Mike said the only time I didn't have cable TV was when there was a brownout.
Does it smell good enough for you in there? How do you like the smell? Is it good?
Michigan! Stop it!
Drew.
That sounds good.
And Mike.
Hey.
In the morning.
I Hate Republicans by the Happy Tones, and suddenly all my email is just blasting off the hook? Is that what email does? You go to my website, peterwerby.com. It's there on the right-hand side. And there's also Idiot Son of an A-Hole. And this comes off the same website. It's bushflash.com. Bushflash.com. You can go right there, and the guy's got Eric Bloomrich. He's got tons of it. Or you can go to his website. I don't know what'll happen if you go to bushflash.com. You can go to Eric Bloomrich as well. ERICBLURICH.com. I hate Republicans. I've been trying to play that for weeks, although I think it came out in mono, didn't it? Jay Hudson, where are we going? Line 3. All right. Hi, it's Night Call. You're on the air. Good evening.
How you doing, Peter?
Sorry for the musical interlude.
Sorry. I've been listening to you for about 2 months now.
Mm-hmm.
And prior to that, I was totally in the dark about politics. So I appreciate you opening my eyes about that.
Oh, well, thank you.
I got a buddy. He's going to the Army, or he's not. He's in the Army. He's going to Iraq.
Yikes.
In 4 months. So, yeah, he's kind of scared about that, definitely. I got 6 other buddies in the Army right now.
Wow. Well, the best we can hope for is that they make it back. But, you know, just as we are sitting here talking, we know that a certain portion of them aren't, and some of them are going to come back with some serious wounds. You know, there's been thousands of American soldiers that have sustained injuries that will be with them for the rest of their lives.
Yeah, we were just talking about that with them, me and my dad. Another thing I'd like to touch upon is people at my work. I asked them, like, what if they support the war.
Mm-hmm.
And then they're like, yeah, you know, it's a good thing that we're going in. Then I ask them this. I'm like, all right, well, you have a son, right? They're like, yeah, he's about 21, you know, drafting, you know, that area, 18 to 25,
yeah.
I think it is. And then they go, oh, well, he wouldn't go, like it's a, you know, a fairy tale.
Right.
It just blows my mind, you know.
Let somebody else do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Another thing about the killing of civilians and all that. I mean, you know how Bush was in Texas, and he was had like one of the highest death tolls on death row.
Oh yeah, he was the Lord High Executioner. He holds the record for executions during a governor's what do they call it? Not reign, something else.
Yeah,
like that.
I think it'd be a reign because he seems to be nice and
tenure. That's it. Yeah.
Yeah, so I guess that's kind of what the past dictates the future on that.
Yeah, well, I said earlier when he says that when he sees those scenes of brutality, he says, this is not the America that I know, that it's always a toss-up between Alabama and Texas as to which state has the highest number of complaints of prison guard brutality. So it's pretty commonplace, particularly it's in all prisons in America, whether it's Michigan or California or New York. So seemingly liberal states, but it's really the worst in those southern states, prisons are.
Yeah. Another thing is I just got this letter from the government, my selective service.
Yeah?
And the thing is I forgot to send it out for like 7 weeks, I forgot.
Mm-hmm.
And seeing how they're going to, if I don't send it in 10 days, they're going to punish me to 5 years or $250,000 fine, but Bush can go into Iraq and totally...
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
If it makes you... If there's comfort in numbers, there's probably millions of young men who are out of compliance with selective service rules that you're supposed, whenever you move or whatever, a lot of people just don't even register. That's right. You still got to register, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, because...
And
I don't know whether they're actually going to put in a draft. I just don't think they could pull this off. I mean, certainly they're not going to do it before the election. Right now, there's not enough troops to police what the Bush has in mind for around the world. But if they tried to put in a draft at any time, I mean, I think the whole country would explode. I mean, it's one thing to say, we support the war in Iraq, and then... Because, well, let me put it this way. During the run-up to the war, They asked something like college students, did they support a war against Iraq? And 80% said yeah. I mean, because everybody was getting this nonsense about weapons of mass destruction and all that. And then when they asked, would you support a war if there was a draft and you had to go? And the statistics flipped. In other words, 80% said no, no way.
Yeah, as long as it's not me, right?
You got it. All right, thanks a lot.
All right, bye.
Appreciate your call. I was talking earlier, one of my usual economic shticks, about a $12 an hour minimum wage. And Troy writes into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. You talk about a $12 minimum wage as though it would be a good thing, but really it wouldn't change anything, says Troy. Prices would quickly rise to compensate for the larger money supply. Sure, the kid behind the counter at McDonald's will be making $12 an hour for his trouble, but the Big Mac will cost forcers and go to the investors or the owners, or a higher proportion of it can go to the workers, the people that are actually doing the work to produce the wealth. And, so now under current circumstances, it's class warfare on the part of the wealthy against the middle class and the working class to hold down wages, to, as our one caller said, to make us work longer and longer hours for the same amount of pay, which essentially is a reduction in pay. So you could have statutes as long as people weren't willing to do a decent thing in their community, and we see that most of these companies aren't. Yeah, they say, well, they got to pay a dollar an hour more, so they're going to move to Mexico. You could have laws that would make it unprofitable for companies to move to Mexico. Huh? All right. Let me see. Was there one other letter here as well? What's our next call, Jay? All right, five. I'll take that first. Hi, WRIF, and you're on the air. Good evening.
Good evening. First of all, I like your show a lot. I try to listen as much as I can, Peter. I wish it was earlier, if nothing else, but I've been seeing about these photos of the Iraqis and all that, and I'm so disturbed. It's so appalling. I've been talking to friends of mine, and a lot of people say, hey, ugly things happen in war, and I just don't buy that. I think that's so wrong what they've done or what they're doing.
Well, I would tell you, anybody who would say that would just flip that off has really lost their moral compass. And rather than that being just a few soldiers, as Bush keeps trying to put it out there, I think that there's millions of people in this country that say, eh, too bad, you know, they're Iraqis, they're ragheads, they're Arabs, it's like a fraternity hazing, what the hell, you know, we're at war with them. I said earlier, too, I don't know if you heard that, I was saying that if they would do that to us, if a small number of Arab men tortured and abused American prisoners like that, we would use that as an indication of the type of society that they came from.
I agree, man. That's so bad. And here's the other thing. Why do we keep saying it's a war? We invaded Iraq, and now we're occupying it. It's
right.
An occupation. You know? Let's say it. That's what it is. We're there occupying it with over 130,000 troops. We got like over 700 troops of ours dead and 3,800 maimed and injured, and we're just sitting here saying, hey, the violence in Iraq or a war in Iraq. We need to think, how the hell are we going to get out of there? If we don't want problems in the future from the Middle East or any other parts of the world, we need to think about how the hell are we going to get out of there and leave it stable, and not just stabilize Iraq, stabilize the whole region.
Mm-hmm.
Start with Israel. Nobody talks about Israel. Why is Israel exempt from everything? You know, it violates UN resolution. It's still occupying a people for over 35 years. There's no talk about them doing a constitution or giving them any kind of rights or anything.
And they
like
have
that.
And they have weapons of mass destruction.
They jailed a guy. I read an article the other day. They jailed their own citizen Israel for over 18 years because he came out and said, "Yes, we do have nuclear weapons."
Mordecai Vanunu.
Yeah.
Some few people know about him. Yeah, they kidnapped him from Italy, and they put him in solitary confinement for 18 years because he had worked at this nuclear facility in Israel, and told the world what the world already knows, that Israel has nuclear weapons. Yeah. All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate your call. More from Stats of the Union. This is in the current Mother Jones magazine. Said, actually, all we got to do, we probably should keep repeating over and over again, the U.S. government is going into debt at the rate of $1 million a minute. It's got to be paid back, so it's going to be paid back by uses, right? Out of our tax dollars. So not only does all these tens of millions go over to Bush's buddies to make war and then to rebuild what the war, the guys that made the war destroyed, we're also going to have to pay the freight on the interest. I think a couple more. The IRS website is maintained by a company incorporated in Bermuda. And thanks to George Bush, since 2001, corporate tax collections have fallen by $11 billion, and now Bush wants another $25 billion for the war in Iraq. At least John Kerry, who's nothing to write home about, I've never written home about him, at least, wants $30 billion for our teachers, our neighbors who teach the next generation, our children. All right, I'm sorry, Jay, I lost where we're going. Okay, thank you. Hi, WRIF, and you're on the air. Good evening.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment about the statements that you made earlier about the work hours. People that work 30 hours instead of 40, and, you know, they should be able to make the same amount of money.
Sure.
I just think it's kind of screwed up. I mean, this might be a little exaggeration, but I heard that Bill Gates could spend $5,000 a minute for, like, 13 years and not even put a dent in his wallet.
Probably.
I'm just wondering why we can't have any of that, you know?
Well, you know, he's not... I mean, that's what happens in this system. You know, because, for instance, I'm in a business, right? I mean, I make about a salary comparable to kind of like lower middle class. I mean, I don't have any qualms about saying that. But on the other hand, and I don't particularly think this is going to happen, I could become a multimillionaire in this business, right? I could be wind up making like Rush Limbaugh. He made like a third. He signed a contract for a third of $1 billion for so that happens. So Gates wound up with all this money. It's not like if you do something that you can stop this flow of money. But Gates says that by the time he dies, he will have no money whatsoever. He intends to give it all away. And his father, Bill Gates Sr., is a very principled man. He's head of the Bill Gates Foundation, and he opposes, for instance, a rollback of what's called the estate tax. The Republicans want to stop all the, a lot of rich people, when they die, they have to pay a tax if it's over, I think, like over $1 million or something like that. And Bill Gates' father says, no, you know, the wealthy should pay these taxes, at that time. But what we got to look at, I think, is a reconfiguration of a society that doesn't have people that are doing very, very important work at every level. Because no matter what kind of work you're doing in this society, it adds to the general well-being, to the commonwealth, if you will. But some people, because of the way this society is structured, can live these obscenely opulent lives where there's tens of millions of people. What is it? 44 million people don't even have health insurance.
I know. I know. I'm a security guard. I'm working 12 hours a night, and, you know, I get paid $8 an hour. I don't even have no health insurance or nothing, you know.
You know what I think? I think that is, that borders on the criminal, that it is a system that would... And now, you're doing an important job. I mean, if you weren't there, people just walk in and help themselves to whatever you're guarding, right?
Yeah, I'm guarding brand new trucks and stuff, you know, yeah. The keys in them and everything.
Yeah. So, in other words, you're doing very, very important work. But because of the way things are structured here is that they, there's a sort of race to the bottom. How low can we drive people's wages down? Yeah, surprised they're not importing people from other countries that they're going to say aren't subject to our minimum wage laws. They'll probably have that next.
Right, and like what you were talking about earlier, how you're saying we as people should be able to do things to, you know, try to change these type of things. But, you know, when people flock together and get in a big group and they're marching for something that they feel is important, 9 times out of 10, it's usually violence, you know, police tripping out on them, you know, riot squad comes out, you know, whatever.
I would say it's you're actually have the figures probably backwards. I would say that the vast majority of time that people get together, and, you know, people... When you're talking about a demonstration, and if you think of the word itself, essentially what you're doing is you're demonstrating your beliefs, your concerns, or what you're for or what you're against. And usually, like for instance during the 1930s when people formed labor unions, they had demonstrations, but the main thing that they wanted to do was to be able to organize to raise their standards of standard of living. And yeah, a lot of times the cops came out at them, and I said 120 years ago, at the behest of the employers, the Chicago police shot down workers in the street because they wanted an 8-hour day. But
right. I mean,
the other option would be just to eat whatever they serve.
All right. Well, thank you for your time.
Well, thank you, and best to you. Yeah, I mean, it always makes me angry when I hear about people making low wages and have to work so hard. Yeah. I mean, I always think of the example of janitors and somehow people that clean up the waste of the rest of us, garbage men and you know, janitors, kind of that's the low end of things. But I always say, who would you rather have go on strike, janitors and garbage men or lawyers? If all the lawyers walked out, hey, and some of my best friends are lawyers. They really are. You know, what in our lives would change? But man, when those people go out on strike, we're in big trouble. So who's more important? All right, I'm going to take a break and then back to introduce our first guest. It'll be Paul Rykoff, and he's a returned Iraqi vet. Following that, it'll be Andrei Codrescu, the NPR commentator, so stay tuned.
The party just doesn't stop at Leopard's Lounge and Broil, Windsor's number one gentleman's club. Every week at Leopard's Lounge, they bring you new girls from all over the world, so it never gets boring. And these girls are hot. Plus, unlike other gentlemen's clubs, at Leopard's Lounge, you never pay a cover charge, ever. They even have free parking. It's the best entertainment value around. This Tuesday night, join Mike Walters from the Riff's Drew and Mike Show for a special Tuesday night Riff Bash. Mike will have tons of giveaways and lots of other special surprises. Come on, guys. You work hard. You deserve a night out. So make sure you make it to Leopard's Lounge and enjoy the finer things in life. You know what I'm talking about. Beer and sexy, beautiful women from all around the world. We'll see you this Tuesday night at Leopard's Lounge in Windsor for a special Riff party. Just 5 minutes from the bridge or tunnel at 1190 Wyandotte West. Call 1-888-653-8881 for Leopard's Lounge and Broil.
Good morning. This is Ray Vinson of American Equity Mortgage. If you're hearing our message at this time, it's probably because you're at work, driving around, or can't sleep. If you can't sleep, I hope it's not because of money problems, but if it is a money problem, American Equity Mortgage can help. You're not alone. The average household has a credit card debt of $6,000 or more and paying a fortune in interest. You see, if you're a homeowner, you can use the equity in your home to consolidate all your bills and have only one payment. Think about that, just one new low monthly payment. Your equity can be used to pay off your auto loans, credit cards, and get a new low fixed rate on your mortgage. You will be saving hundreds of dollars each month. American Equity Mortgage specializes in homeowners with less than perfect credit. We have helped thousands of people just like you get back on track. You can call our office right now, and a loan specialist will call you first thing in the morning. That's American Equity Mortgage. Call toll-free 888-71-LOAN-1, 888-71-LOAN, then the number one.
Dr. T4 and the Windsor Laser Eye Institute. More experience, more options, more value.
More experience.
Did you know that Dr. T4 at Windsor Laser Eye Institute has performed well over 30,000 LASIK procedures? Or that he was the first in North America to perform LASIK over a decade ago?
More options.
Now, Dr. T4 is the first to offer custom cornea wavefront LASIK, an advanced system light years beyond conventional LASIK, so that you can enjoy a future free from glasses or contacts. Now, more than ever, Dr. T4 can customize treatment specific to you, ensuring the best possible results and safety.
More value.
With the most experience, personalized treatment, and state-of-the-art technology, why would you trust your eyes to anyone else? Call 800-663-IC for a free one-on-one consultation with Dr. T4. Call 800-663-IC or go to WLEI.com. The Windsor Laser Eye Institute. More experience, more options, more value.
Attention car buyers, Parkway Chrysler Jeep wants your business, and here's what they'll do to get it. All Jeeps are on sale. Jeep Liberty 4x4s, $129 a month. Grand Cherokee 4x4s, $169 a month. They have incredible deals on Chryslers like the all-new Pacifica, only $169 a month. PT Cruisers, just $129 a month. Parkway is well-stocked with the all-new 300C and a great selection of Crossfires. Parkway will get you out of your old lease and into a new one for free. Everyone gets employee pricing and lease loyalty. Credit is not a problem. Stop the music and listen to this. If you feel trapped or buried in your current trade-in, relax. Come to Parkway Chrysler Jeep and get the full appraised value plus an additional $2,000. That's right, $2,000. This offer will end soon, so don't wait. Get in before the $1,000 May bonus cash offer ends. Parkway is on a mission to get and keep your business. No one walks away. Parkway will beat any deal. Parkway Chrysler Jeep on Grasshead at 16.5 Mile in Clinton Township. Just show up, sign up, and ride.
Check your local paper for details.
When you're talking about speed, there's no comparison between Comcast high-speed internet and DSL. But to help us clearly demonstrate the difference, we've asked Carl Wingfeather, one of the world's fastest men, to represent Comcast.
Hello.
And Gary Hudson, some guy we found in a donut shop, to represent DSL.
Hi, how you doing?
On the count of three, these two will race 100 yards. One, two, three! Carl burst out of the gate and is closing in on the finish like a bullet, while Gary appears to be licking some jelly he spilled on his shirt.
Hey, where'd another guy go?
Well, there you have it. There's no comparison. Comcast is up to three times faster than 768K DSL. So get connected to the number one high-speed internet provider in America. Comcast High-Speed Internet. Nothing else comes close. Get connected for just $29.99 a month for 6 months. Call 1-888-COMCAST today. Offer ends June 30th. Restrictions apply. Download speed compared to 768K DSL. Actual speeds may vary. Installation fees may apply. Call for pricing and service details.
All right, thank you very much. This is Peter Werby. WRF Detroit is where we're broadcasting from. And here's an interview I did earlier this week.
Thank you very much for joining me. Anybody that's listened to this broadcast over the last, a year and a half now, you know that we have been continually discussing the particulars of the war in Iraq, whether there was weapons of mass destruction, whether preemptive strikes were justified, whether we were getting all the information, what happened on the battlefield, what about the revolt that's going on now against the U.S. occupation. And we've had lots of experts, a lot of policy wonks, and, you know, bless them, people that have helped us get an idea of what's going on, and particularly that gave us a different view from what we were getting from the White House and a lot of the mainstream media, particularly at the beginning when everybody said, yes, there was definitely weapons of mass destruction. Well, I've said, and if you've listened to this, I've always wondered what the reaction is going to be of those men and women who actually did the fighting there when they came back. What would they think about the statements that many of us who are opposed, were opposed to the war, are opposed to the occupation, would have to say? What were their experiences? Was it one that they felt good about, bad about, mixed? Well, we have a wonderful opportunity. Joining us is Paul Rykoff, and he's an Iraq War veteran. And, Paul, welcome to the broadcast. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you, Peter. Pleasure to be here.
Well, as I told you, I've never heard a Democratic Party response to President Bush's presidential radio address every Saturday, and I just happened to hear yours. And how was it that you wound up giving the Democratic response to George Bush?
Well, you touch on a critical piece in that it's usually given by a congressman or a governor or a senator. But I came back in the middle or beginning of February, and I came off active duty in March. At that time, I started speaking out vocally about my experiences, unaffiliated to any party or any organization, just trying to give people a little bit of honest truth about what's going on over there. And I went to Amherst College, a small school in Massachusetts, and spoke there about 2 weeks ago at the invitation of the Dean of Students. That kind of got a lot of press in the local area and got people thinking. And after that, I was in touch with some people from the Kerry campaign, and they asked me if I'd be interested in delivering the Democratic National Response. Now, I'm not a member of the DNC. I don't work for John Kerry. I'm not even registered as a Democrat. But I realize that it's a tremendous opportunity on the national stage to talk about my experiences. And I told them that as long as they gave me absolute and total creative control over everything that I said, I'd be happy to do it. And that's what happened. I took advantage of it.
Hmm. Now, Paul, I'm sure there's a lot of veterans listening, and they'd be curious to know with who you served during your tour of duty in Iraq.
Right. I was attached to the 3rd Infantry Division. Mechanized in the original push up to Baghdad, and then late fall or beginning of the fall we were transferred over to the 1st Armored Division that continued to stay on in Iraq. I just want to also make a note that obviously I'm not speaking on behalf of the Army or the National Guard, and you know, I don't want to give people the impression I'm speaking out against the troops. Nobody supports the troops more than I do. I'm just trying to bring a truthful voice to the discussion. As you talked about earlier, Peter, most of the Americans get their opinions from policy wonks or some military expert or some talking head on a news channel. And I'm trying to keep it real and bring a normal person's perspective to what's going on over there. And that's what I'm hoping to do today and on all the other appearances I'm making coming up.
Now, you're in the National Guard now, and you were in the reserves in Baghdad, right? I mean, you were called up as part of the...
That's right. Well, actually, I volunteered to be a part of the 1st Division to go over, which was the 3rd Infantry Division. I don't have a crystal ball, Peter, but I knew from the outset that this wasn't going to be a short conflict. And as a member of the military, I was going to have to go sooner or later. I made a commitment to my country and to the Army, and I was going to honor that commitment. So I did volunteer to go with the first wave and was right in the middle of stuff in Baghdad.
And that really isn't the first you saw of devastation. Am I right in reading here that you were also part of rescue operations after September 11th in New York City?
Yeah, that's right, Peter. I lived on 24th Street in Manhattan, and when the towers fell, I was there pretty much right afterward with some other guys, and we participated in the Ground Zero rescue effort for the first couple of hours voluntarily, and then my New York National Guard unit was activated later that night. We stayed on for a couple weeks after that to try to help out and do whatever we could, but that was... You know, obviously, like you said, devastating, and words can't really begin to express how that impacted me and everyone else in New York.
Paul Rykoff. Rykoff is my guest, and he's returned from Iraq where he was an active duty soldier. And yet, on your radio broadcast, answering George W. Bush, who's posed as the one who supports the troops, who is you know, military himself, yet you had a lot of criticisms of the way the commander-in-chief, I mean, essentially, although I don't think they always like to get that far up the chain of command, I mean, eventually he's the guy in charge, right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, he is the commander-in-chief, and the thing that kind of ticked me off, to be honest with you, Peter, is that as a combat leader, everybody in the military knows you're responsible for everything your people do and also what they fail to do. So when I saw the press conference 2 weeks ago and the president said he couldn't think of a single mistake that he'd made over the course of his administration, it really got me cranked up. And, you know, I'm not only questioning him, I'm questioning the entire civilian administrative body that I think right now is misusing our military. Our men and women are doing everything they can and so much more than they were trained to do. And I want people to understand that I support them 100%. I don't think bringing them home right now is the answer. I mean, we broke it over there, so it's, in essence, we bought it. But I think we need to really have a constructive dialogue and think about where we're going. And I think we need to involve some more people who've been there. And I think the fact that Bush and some of these other guys in the administration have never served and have never been in a combat zone is really, you know, driven and given them this short-sighted perspective that they've used to get us into this mess.
How would you estimate where your views fall along the lines of other people that you served with? And you were a first lieutenant, so you were the head of a unit, am I correct?
Yeah, that's right. I had 38 guys under my command, a light infantry unit, so we're grunts. I mean, we're the door kickers and the guys who patrol and deal pretty intimately with the people. I won't speak on behalf of all of them. I just know that I'm speaking on behalf of some of them who haven't really spoken up yet. This is a natural progression, man. I mean, when soldiers come back, they start to talk about their experiences, and that's how people really find out about what goes on. So I'm not going to say I'm indicative of everyone, but I think I'm kind of the tip of the iceberg. And since I've spoken out, you know, countless soldiers have approached me, and reservists and people who are rotating back and beyond the military who are saying, you know, we kind of had a feeling this is the way it was going, or we're frustrated, or we want to get involved, and we want to see a better, more honest dialogue. I'm just trying to bring the truth out right now.
Well, tell us about some of your experiences, because I was just startled when I heard your response on the radio the other day where you said there wasn't enough vehicles, there wasn't enough ammunition, there wasn't enough medical supplies, there wasn't even enough water. And here we think of the United States Army, which it is the most technologically advanced armed force that the world has ever known, and yet how was it that you were missing all these things? And maybe put it tell us kind of in a sense a story of it. I mean, how did it, I mean, it's pretty hot over there, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely hot over there, and I mean, that's scattered, you know. I mean, some places in the north, it is really calm, and I think that when people ask me, I tell them that the Iraqi people really have made tremendous progress. And the American soldiers are doing amazing things to help the people of Iraq over there. And the Iraqi people are better off. My question is, are the American people better off? And I don't think they are. And are the American soldiers better off? And I certainly don't think they are. Beyond the fact that we had Vietnam-era flak jackets, and we didn't have armored vehicles, and we had to hotwire some SUVs that were left over from the Saddam regime, ripped the doors off, and it was kind of like the A-Team, so we could patrol the local neighborhood. These are the challenges we had to overcome because the war was rushed and because there wasn't an understanding of what the culture was like or what the reaction was going to be from the Iraqi people. And beyond that, we were asked to do things we weren't trained for. I mean, I got 19, 21-year-old guys in my unit who were trained as machine gunners or trained as squad automatic weapon gunners or grenadiers. These guys aren't trained to check gas levels at a gas station or ensure that corruption isn't going on in the ministry or, you know, doing all the other multitude of really civilian or peacekeeping type missions that they've been asked to do. So it's not just the equipment. It's that you're asking these guys to do stuff they weren't designed for and they weren't prepared for. You're ripping a kid out of, the South, say like a state like Alabama, a 19-year-old kid who's never left Alabama. Now you stick him in Baghdad and you're asking him to communicate to a crowd full of Iraqis in Arabic. I mean, you're not setting that kid up for success. That's not what he was trained to do.
I was going to ask you about we were talking about the equipment, and you said that it was rushed. I mean, Bush rushed into it because we were told that these weapons of mass destruction were lethal and that an attack could be imminent, immediate on the part of Saddam Hussein. How did you and others feel when you found out that, in fact, there weren't any?
Well, I'll tell you this. Obviously, I think that dealt a morale blow to the troops. I mean, people are talking about whether my speaking out is going to somehow affect the morale. I mean, my speaking out can't even begin to impact morale in the same way the fact that we haven't found any WMD has. I mean, I was there for 10 months, and we had a Scud factory in my sector. We looked high and low. Peter, I'm telling you, we looked. And I didn't see any sort of trace of WMD, and nobody else I've talked to has. And if that's the reason why we went over there to declare war, and that's the reason why we invaded Iraq to find WMD, then we failed, and our mission is not accomplished. And that's not the fault of the military. That's the fault of the people who sent the military over there to do it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've never been in the military, and certainly not in active combat. But from what I've read, I mean, a good intellectual, I read about war, right? You experience it directly.
Right.
I read a book about it. But it said that after a while, it all gets very local and very personal, that the main thing you want to do is keep yourself and your comrades alive.
Yeah.
And is that the way it works out? And policy decisions after a while seem pretty far away.
Yeah, that's exactly right, Peter. You hit it on the head. I mean, guys go to war, and there's a number of reasons why politicians send guys to war. But, I mean, you guys live in the Detroit area, or you guys live in America, and you know people who go away to war, and they're average guys. These are, for the most part, middle-class and lower-middle-class guys. Rich people aren't generally joining up in the Army and the Marine Corps to go off and fight the wars because they don't feel like the military has anything to offer. So a lot of guys join for the college money or maybe join for the experience or join to build a resume or join for the camaraderie. But ultimately, when you get over there, it's all about the guys to the left and the right of you. You don't fight for George Bush, and you really aren't even fighting for the flag and all the other things that come along with it. Ultimately, you're fighting for your buddies next to you, and that's what you want to do is ensure that those people close to you, your family, essentially, get home safe. That's your ultimate motivation, is making sure that your buddies get home alive.
Paul Rykoff is my guest on the Peter Werbe Show. Paul Rykoff was in Iraq for 10 months as part of combat units, and he's joined us to tell us about his experiences. One of the things that always has occurred, when you're not just having traditional frontal positional warfare like World War II, and you're the people that are shooting at you who become the enemy are often indistinguishable from the people that live around there, whether it's Vietnam or Iraq now. There appears to be that the hatred for the enemy kind of becomes generalized to the entire population.
Yeah, I mean, it's very frustrating. For the most part, it's not what traditional images of war look like. It's not, it's not Da Nang, it's not the Bush in Vietnam, and it's not the trenches of World War One. It's something very different. And at times, there is head-to-head symmetrical contact where you're shooting at them and they're shooting at you. But in large part, at least in the time I was there, our casualties came from, like you said, this gray area where you're looking at a guy and you can't tell if he's a friend or foe. And that's what the guerrillas want. They want you not to be able to tell, so that when you do get attacked, you retaliate against civilians. And we didn't do that. I mean, my guys were incredibly self-controlled. I mean, to the point where they really endangered themselves. And that's the fine line we have to walk over there. But a big problem for us was IEDs, improvised explosive devices. This is when the bad guys take a bunch of bombs, grenades, rockets, artillery rounds. They wrap them up with some detonation cord and hook it up to either a doorbell ringer or a cell phone. They hide in the window, and they put in a bunch of garbage on the side of the road, and they wait for you to walk by or drive by. And once you do that, they hit the cell phone, the doorbell ringer, or the garage door opener, and it detonates a bomb that blows up a car or blows up a bunch of guys. And you want to turn around. You want to shoot back. You want to be able to retaliate and fight back against the guys who hurt you. But you can't because they're gone or they're hiding in a window. So there's really not that. You have the desire to fight back, but there's no way to fight back to. So you feel like you're kind of just walking around, and you only find the enemy when he finds you.
Now, of course, we've all been treated to these photographs, and kind of I always like to be precise in language. I've always called them prisoner abuse photos. Actually, I saw in the New York Times today, since you're in New York City, you may have seen it. It's called the torture photos.
Right.
I mean, pretty obvious what your response is going to be, but what is your opinion of those? I mean, obviously, all of us are sickened by them, human beings being treated like that by anyone. But did other stuff like that go on that you'd ever seen? Was this something, or was this something that was known, that this type of behavior was practiced upon prisoners?
No, in my experience, honestly, Peter, I had never seen anything like that. And those guys are really an embarrassment to the military and everybody in the uniform. And under no way, shape, or form would that be allowed in my unit or among any of the guys I was with. As an individual soldier, you have a responsibility to reject any order that's called unlawful. If somebody tells you to blow up a village full of civilians, you don't have to follow that order. And it's your right as an individual soldier to stand up and say, hey, man, this is wrong. I'm not doing it. And those soldiers have that same obligation, and they just, you know, didn't take it into account. They blew it off. And they took disgusting, ridiculous pictures. And I hope they're punished to the full extent of the law. And I don't think that's an indication of a widespread problem. At least I hope it's not. In my experience, my guys always treated the Iraqi captives or detainees with incredible respect and in accordance with the Geneva Convention, which is what guides us on proper treatment of prisoners, POWs, and captives.
Well, the only thing that struck me is that not only the brutality and the desire to humiliate, but also, I guess, the self-confidence that they could actually record that without any repercussions.
Yeah, I mean, it brings up a bigger point, and the bigger point is that you've got a lot of soldiers over there that are in a very difficult position. And the thing I tried to ram home to my guys all the time is be very careful about what you do, because any wrong move you make can become an international incident. And that's what's happened now, and it's ultimately endangered the way we're viewed by all these other people. For the most part, the Iraqi people were really kind to us, Peter. They were really not generous. They're funny. They were welcoming. I mean, there are times when we kick in their door, look for bad guys, wouldn't be any, and they'd invite us in for tea afterward because they understood that we were there to try to eradicate the problem. But I don't think that, for the most part, the resistance is a large number of the Iraqi people. Now, that may change over time. I won't, you know, claim to be an Iraqi cultural expert. But, you know, these guys are in a tough position over there, the American soldiers. And these types of things are horrible, and they're going to have a detriment over time. But, I mean, it's just another issue that brings up the fact that these guys are walking a really, really fine line.
Sure. Paul Rykoff is my guest on the Peter Werby Show. Paul spent 10 months in Iraq. And here, I mean, I need you, I don't, not that I think you would, but pull no punches, but myself and thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of people around the world were saying no to the war in Iraq. How did you feel, and how do you think other GIs felt that expressed themselves to you? I mean, have no qualms. If you think we were the worst people in the world, have no qualms about saying so.
No. I mean, Peter, I live in New York City, and I have a lot of friends who come out all over the place on this issue. And, you know, when I was down at Fort Stewart getting ready to go overseas, I'd be on a cell phone talking to my friends who were protesting in New York.
Oh.
And I understand that because somebody's protesting doesn't mean they're protesting with soldiers. And there's a distinction to be made there. Oftentimes, the people who are protesting are the people who have the best interests of the soldiers in mind. And I understand that. As I told you earlier, the WMD argument, I mean, if you're going to use that as the crux to go to war, you better be right. Otherwise, you're stuck like a cop who shot somebody in a dark alley who you thought had a gun, and ultimately it turns out to be his wallet or something else. And I feel like that's where we are now. The Bush administration ultimately used the WMD rationale to scare the hell out of the American people, because when they said we were going to go over there because of an Al-Qaeda tie, they couldn't prove it, or a 9/11 tie, they couldn't prove it. And when they said we were going to go over there to liberate and arrest an oppressed people and overthrow a ruthless dictator, well, the American people said, yeah, that's a problem, but it's not enough to send our sons and daughters overseas in order to declare war. But finally, when they came back and said, all right, WMD is a threat, and people in Topeka, Kansas have to be worried about Al-Qaeda and be worried about Saddam Hussein, then people got scared enough to support the war. And I think the Bush administration and all the civilian administrators took advantage of that fear. They played off that fear. They waged a war on its behalf.
Tell us a little about the media attention that you've been getting and what you make of it all.
Dude, it's insane. I mean, I'm an ordinary guy. I mean, I'm not a celebrity. I'm not a policy wonk. I'm certainly not rich. Like, I'm talking to you now from the bathroom in my studio apartment in New York City because it's the only place my cell phone gets really good reception. I don't have a secretary. I don't have a network to take this. I just got a website up that should be up by the end of the day today. It's paulreichoff.com. And that's just to try to bring people together who are feeling like I am. A lot of people have come out and said, hey, man, you're speaking the truth, and we need more people like that. And there are other people out there like that. And if they're your listeners, I urge them to get in contact with me and continue to speak the truth so we can get more people besides myself on the airwaves, on TV, speaking publicly in your local bar or wherever it is, just telling the truth about what they experienced and how they feel, because it's time that the real people took back the discussion in this country. Because this is going to be the most pivotal election, I think, in recent history, and could definitely determine where our country goes from here.
Well, Paul, my last name often is hard for people to spell. Yours is even harder.
Sure.
You can link to my site, and by the time people hear this, I will have a link to your site. My site is Peter Werbe, WERBE.com. Paul's last name is spelled R-E-I-C-K.
R-I-E, Peter.
What is it now?
Sorry, R-I-E-C-K. H-O-F-F.
Okay. So the guy from the Associated Press gave me the wrong spelling.
He's a good guy, though.
He is. we'll give him a shout-out to Curtis Ellis, indeed. Have you been on any major media outlets?
Yeah. It's been kind of crazy. I mean, I was on Fox News last night with Hannity and Combs. I was on Paul Azan, CNN. I've been on NPR. I'm going to be on MSNBC. I've been on ABC, CBS. I've been all over, man. I really had no idea the response was going to be this great.
Wow.
But I think it's an indication that people want to hear the truth and that we need to bring more people like myself out in order to educate American people about what's going on.
Now, Sean Hannity is one of those people that we call a chicken hawk. Are you familiar with that phrase?
Yeah, I'm real familiar with it, Peter.
Okay.
I mean, all of us in the military have become pretty familiar with that term lately.
Because that's, and I should tell people that in case they're not, that those are people that particularly during the Vietnam War era were able to scam almost all. None of those neocons served at all. Bush was able to jump through a lot of hoops, get into a coveted Air National Guard position, whether he was there or not. And yet they were big supporters of the war. So what they essentially were doing were urging on the people of that generation, like our guest Paul Reichoff, to go fight in Vietnam, where they were rooting on the troops from the safety of home. So Hannity, Sean Hannity, falls into that category. How did he come at you?
I mean, he says he has a lot of respect for me and the people in the military. I think that's probably right. But ultimately, he's never been on the ground over there, so I don't think he can talk about it intelligently. He can have an opinion. He's, of course, entitled to it, but it's not nearly going to be as informed as mine. I mean, that's a fact. And I think that other soldiers understand that. We want people to lead us in. If we're going to do this whole battle, combat, inevitable, never-ending war on terror, we better have somebody who's been there. And it's not just because you've been shot at and you've had the guys next to you injured. It's bigger than that, Peter. It's about understanding that when you declare war and you wage war and you send soldiers overseas, it affects their family, and it has a ripple effect that reverberates into every element. It affects the way their kids are raised. It affects the divorce rate. It affects their financial status. It really screws up people's lives. So if you're going to do this, you better make sure you're right. Nobody hates war more than soldiers, Peter, and I think that's the case all the time.
Yeah. Well, we only have a couple minutes left. This war seems to be unending. I mean, a lot of the people in power don't like it compared with Vietnam, and there's a lot of reasons to say that it isn't. But, I mean, that whole idea that they said a generation ago about the light at the end of the tunnel, suddenly we're not even seeing a light at the end of the tunnel. They're saying they're going to keep 150,000 troops there for, who knows how long. They're calling up another 57,000 men and women. I don't know. I mean, where can it possibly all end is a question I don't think anybody has an idea, and particularly the people in Washington.
Yeah, I think that's right, Peter. And, most of the people in Washington don't have kids in the military. I mean, people in the military are probably a lot like your listener base. And the people who are listening to this show right now probably know somebody who's in the military, have a family member in the military, or themselves been in the military. Because the military is in large part made up of the middle class and the lower middle class. The upper class doesn't go overseas to fight war. I mean, that's been true since Vietnam. And it's not like World War I and World War II, everybody got together and fought for a common cause. It's very different. So I think this has larger ramifications on the way our society moves forward. If we're going to continue to wage war, it's time that the rich started putting their 2 cents in and started putting the blood on the field also, and if not, at least contributing some money. And it doesn't have to be the military. I don't know if it's the Peace Corps, AmeriCorps, or whatever, but we need to shoulder this burden together, not just the ordinary Joes.
The fact that you and we haven't mentioned this since the beginning of our talk here, and we've only have about 60 seconds left, is that you gave the Democratic Party response to George Bush's weekly report. Am I correct in saying then you think that things would be a lot better with John Kerry as the president?
Well, I mean, I took the DNC's, I took the position there to make that speech because they're the ones that gave it to me. If the president wanted me to give the presidential address, I would have been all too happy to take advantage of that opportunity to be given the same creative liberties. But ultimately, the way I come out on it is John Kerry the best answer in the world? I don't know if he is, but right now for me, he's a whole lot better than the alternative. George Bush had 4 years, he had a chance to try it, and now it's time to give somebody else a shot. And John Kerry has been there. He's been shot at, and right now I met him a few weeks ago, and he convinced me to be, you know, he's a person who cares. I mean, he at least is concerned in talking about some of these issues for the middle class and talking about some of these issues for the soldiers, and he can admit he's wrong. And I think that's a whole lot better than the rhetoric I'm hearing right now coming out of the White House.
And there's been attacks on him recently that his wounds weren't legitimate and his medals weren't legitimate and he was an anti-war protester. That all seems so low.
Yeah, I mean, I think so. These people went after John McCain in 2000, and they've gone after other people who have notable war records, and I'm sure they'll come after me at some point. But, I mean, ultimately, let the record stand for itself and look at the paperwork and you know, decide for yourself ultimately who you believe. I mean, I've looked at Kerry's records, and they look good to me, and to go back 30 years later and try to question whether a guy got a Purple Heart or not, I think is really kind of petty. I've submitted guys for Purple Hearts, and ultimately, you know, if a guy gets injured, he gets the freaking heart, and all you have to do is go to the doctor and say, hey, do you have documentation that he was wounded? Yeah, he was wounded. Okay, there's your Purple Heart. I mean, it's not really much room for controversy. So if he was awarded then, I think it's really ridiculous to go back, you know, 30, 40 years later and try to microanalyze it.
I agree.
It's just not an issue. I think it's really trivializing and politicizing the whole military situation right now.
Paul Rykoff, thanks for joining me on the Peter Werby Show.
Thank you very much, Peter. My pleasure. Anytime.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Oh, hey, Rick. How's it going?
I think mine's too big.
Too big, huh? Well, let me see. Oh, that is big.
Told you.
That's a lot bigger than mine.
Yeah, my wife can't handle it. It's too big for her.
Really? Well, let me see that again.
All right, take a look.
Wow, that is the biggest mortgage rate I've seen in quite a while. You know, you should have tried CompleteMortgageSearch.com.
CompleteMortgageSearch.com?
Sure, CompleteMortgageSearch.com takes the work out of finding the best mortgage rate. Just a few clicks and CompleteMortgageSearch.com shops your loan to the reputable lenders and saves you thousands.
I shopped around. It took forever. And as you can see, mine's just too big.
Well, even if you're locked into another lender, log on to CompleteMortgageSearch.com for a free second opinion. It's not hard.
I'm stuck with this big one.
Well, everybody's got their problems.
Yeah.
Hey, guys. Bigger isn't always better. Everyone says that they have the lowest rates. Let CompleteMortgageSearch.com tell you the truth. CompleteMortgageSearch.com. They do the work. You get the money.
Everyone wants a great dentist. But what makes him great? A wonderful, passionate, friendly staff. Cutting-edge technology. Virtually pain-free procedures. Yes. That's what Dr. Katz in Livonia is offering to you. Call the office of Dr. Katz in Livonia now and take advantage of a special offer. A complete set of digital x-rays, a comprehensive exam, and a consultation for only $1. Interested? Call 734-464-2000 now. Dr. Katz in Livonia has been practicing cutting-edge dentistry for over 34 years. He is the pioneer in virtually pain-free and advanced dental procedures. Offering micro-air abrasion, drill-less pain-free fillings, gentle-touch hygiene visits, sedation, and TMJ treatment. As well as Invisalign wireless braces and one-hour teeth whitening. Your complete source of general, family, and cosmetic dentistry. Call Dr. Katz in Livonia today to take advantage of this incredible offer at 734-464-2000. That's 734-464-2000. Call and tell them you want to experience the difference in dentistry for only $1. Dr. Katz in Livonia, 734-464-2000. Call now, 734-464-2000 for Dr. Katz in Livonia.
If you've been waiting for just the right time to get Dish One Up Satellite, here it is. Right now, you can get free equipment and installation on up to four rooms and a free built-in DVR.
They call that a digital video recorder.
This DVR normally retails for $600 and can pause, rewind, and record up to 35 hours of programming and will change the way you watch TV forever. You see, it allows you to watch a one-hour TV show in just 40 minutes by skipping through all the commercials. Imagine that. And unlike recording with a VCR, there's no complicated timers or messy tapes. You just go to the TV Guide channel, click the show you want, and choose to record it once or every time it's on. It's that.
Host of Night Call, Peter Werby on 101 WRIF Detroit.
Thank you very much for joining me. A pleasure to be with you, as always. And also a pleasure to welcome back someone who has been on this broadcast I don't know how many times. I was just looking back at some of the books our guest has written, and at least one goes back to 1992. It's a transplanted Detroiter by way of Romania, Andre Codrescu. Andre Codrescu is a novelist, essayist, poet, filmmaker, and he's founded and edits the literary journal Exquisite Corpse. It's at corpse.org. A lot of this you can find on my website as well. Peter Werby, Andre Codrescu, welcome back to the Peter Werby Show.
Well, thank you, Peter. Great pleasure as always.
Of course, the one thing I didn't mention was that you're a weekly commentator on National Public Radio's All Things Considered, because I was going to ask you, I was almost going to say, the beloved commentator. I think that's true, too. I mean, that must give you, I don't know, what sense did that give you if I would have said Andre Codrescu, the beloved NPR commentator?
Well, I would think that you're only talking to my friends. There are quite a few people who probably feel the opposite of beloved, who would love to throw something at me. I get plenty of... I don't get any, you know, in-the-middle stuff, but I get plenty of hate mail, and there are the people who just love me.
Well, I remember quite a few years ago, at around Christmas time, you had advocated, or you said you were going to be, what was it, happy when the rapture occurred because all of those right-wing Christians would be out of here, and you got incredible amount of hate mail, and you were, you know, asked to apologize.
Well, I thought I was being funny, you know, satire, but there were 30,000 angry letters reserving places for me in the lake of fire with numbers and letters.
50,000 came in?
About 30,000.
30,000. That's amazing.
Yeah, but it was a little campaign organized in churches by, the Christian Coalition, because they were taking on the media at the time, and they haven't stopped since, I suppose. Although I'm sure that a lot of the media has come around to their way of thinking, because they are quite intimidating.
Well, I can't believe that 30 rapture-believing Christians had actually listened to the broadcast. You think it was part of a campaign?
Well, 30,000 wrote in.
I know, but I...
actually the exact number who listened was 4.
Well, you have a brand new book out, a novel this time. It's called Wakefield, and we've talked about other novels you've done in the past. Casanova in Bohemia, I believe, was the last one. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah. And, you know, I think you'll have to excuse me if I'm not inventive enough to be a poet or a novelist. So I may have asked you this before, but how in the world in your life do you find so much time to do everything that you're doing? If this is not too personal, what is an Andre Codrescu creative day seem like? Edison said that genius is 10% inspiration and 90% perspiration.
Well, there are three things, Peter. I don't sleep. That has to do with the fact that I was born in Transylvania and vampires don't need sleep.
There you go.
Two is that I can write and do everything else. Eat, fly, make love, give interviews, And and three, I don't need to use a writing implement anymore because I've had a computer grafted into me, and all I have to do is close my eyes and I can holographically project a keyboard and the screen, and then I just move my fingers a little bit and up pops novel.
You know what I think the real element is, and you're the second or third person, because I'm fascinated by people that have a great amount of production. What I can do essentially is talk a lot. Doing other stuff beyond that, I never can do it. The constant is no sleep.
The constant is no sleep, and the other thing is that if you have somebody follow you around who types as fast as you talk, then you have lots and lots of text.
There you go. Well, how about the creative process? And we may have talked about this as well, but this is something that intrigues me. You have this steady creative output of poetry, of novels, this brand new one, Wakefield. Let me get to this. I like the title of this one so much, although it's not. The Muse is always half dressed in New Orleans, and you teach English at Louisiana State University in Baton Rouge down the road. So how does the Muse work for Andre Codrescu? I mean, how all of a sudden do you get the idea for Wakefield?
Well, I can sort of see what you're getting at, Peter, but I'm not going to go that way. The Muse is always there, but I have a secret alchemical formula, actually, for turning excrement into gold. And that was given to me in Transylvania when I was born. But, yeah, I mean, to actually pursue that some other way, you know, I mean, I have certain questions, and then when I ask them, I try to write to find out answers. And Wakefield is this book that tries to answer all my questions about the just deposed period of the 90s, the decade of the 90s, which seems like a dream now. I was trying to figure out what was it we lived through for 10 years, and Wakefield is a middle-aged guy who makes a deal with the devil in an attempt to try and find that out.
Anything autobiographical?
Well, no, because I don't make deals like that, you know. I could have been working for ABC News.
Yeah, now, I've always wondered about those Faustian deals, because people have read enough of Faust or similar stories to realize that the devil comes to collect his due, right?
Oh, yeah, but I think everybody who works for the major news agencies, everybody who's in government who has one-syllable names are all people who've made the deal with the devil.
Wakefield, interestingly, because nonfiction, for instance, I remember when we spoke quite a few years ago about your return to Romania after the so-called revolution, The Hole in the Flag, and then there's always a subtitle, An Exile's Story of Return and Revolution. Wakefield doesn't conjure up much as a title, but I guess titles of fiction rarely do.
Well, actually, there are two buried secrets in the title. One is Wakefield is about as Anglo a name as you can get, and when you look at that cover and it says Wakefield by Andre Codrescu, however you spell that, it creates a momentary disorientation. And the other is that Wakefield is the title of one of my favorite stories in the whole world, is by Nathaniel Hawthorne. And it's just a three-page story that Hawthorne wrote in the middle of the 19th century about a London clerk who goes to work in the morning wearing a Hamburg and an umbrella under his arm, just like thousands of other English clerks. And then he disappears for 20 years and doesn't come home for 20 years. And one day he returns and knocks on his wife's door and says, "I'm back." And it turns out that Wakefield, for 20 years, has taken quarters across the street from his old house and has hidden there and watched life go by. And I thought that was just an incredibly intriguing and interesting story by Hawthorne about the beginning of this, the kind of industrial anonymous drudge, the London clerk who disappears in this mass of workers. And I thought, well, how about placing him at the end of the 20th century in the 90s, which seemed very appropriate somehow. And so this is my book, Wakefield, is Wakefield. It's Hawthorne's Wakefield update.
My guest on the Peter Werbe Show is Andrei Codrescu, commentator for NPR, poet, author. We're talking about his brand-new book, Wakefield. I actually have the advance uncorrected proof. Has it been released?
It's out now, and the proof you have has certain very important things changed, including the last sentence.
Oh, all right. Well, that's interesting.
You never got the last sentence. Probably. It's not in the book.
I should tell people also that you're going to be in Detroit, a city that you spent, in fact, where we met years and years ago, and you're going to be reading from Wakefield at the Scarab Club, downtown Detroit. Actually, what do they call that area? The what arts? I can't even think of where they, right across the street from the Detroit Institute of Arts. The Scarab Club, and in back of it on John R. It's going to be 7:30 Friday, May 14th. Why can't I think of what they call that area with the main library and Wayne State University? The Cultural Center. That's what it is. No wonder I had trouble thinking about it. So what, I mean, without giving away the book, I mean, that's why it's always a little difficult to talk about fiction with an author. How does, you said, you know, the anonymous drudge, I mean, how does that explain the 90s? In fact, in many ways, you think of the 90s of these very upfront, dynamic characters making money in .com and, you know, and then culturally and music really in your face. Where's the anonymous drudge come in?
Well, let me just say that I'm really happy to be back in Detroit because it's my formative city. I wouldn't have a language the way it works if I didn't first come to Detroit and I came to America. But as to your question, yeah, it is the 90s, and everybody believes in miracles, and there's plenty of charlatans around. And my character, Wakefield, is a motivational speaker of all things. He's a relative of all the tent preachers and snake oil salesmen of the 19th century. He goes around and makes up talks, but with a difference. The CEOs of certain companies have realized that the economy is overheated, the workers are overmotivated, and the fact is that Wakefield depresses them, actually. He doesn't motivate them very much. So they hire him secretly to kind of depress workers, to bring them down. And so that's a kind of a thing. This is, Wakefield knows this, and he does this, and yet because he's been doing it for quite some time, and everything seems to be on the move, and everything is shot through with surges of optimism. He suspects that a cataclysm is at hand, that there is actually a collapse, and in fact, all this faux joy in the workplace hides an incredible amount of drudgery and actual dehumanization and so on. And he feels this deeply, and so do people around him. But it's all covered up by this rara of the 90s that we still remember, but we won't remember for long.
Well, let's talk about a little about the 90s. Certainly in the liberal canon, C-A-N-O-N, I know you know that, not with the double N, but in the liberal canon, the 90s, particularly from 1992 to the year 2000, these were the good old days. These were the good society made whole and everything like that, and it's all been downhill since the election of 2000. But you're not quite as happy or share that sanguine view of the 90s, eh?
No, I don't. I think that the 90s were a golden age, very much like the Gilded Age that Mark Twain talked about, or a certain period at the end of the 19th century when a tremendous amount of entrepreneurs rushed to take advantage of new technologies, and there was a revolution in the 90s having to do with communications, and it is probably going to be remembered very, very fondly as a time of entrepreneurial opportunities. But it was also a time that hit a lot of changes that are structurally very damaging. Things like the entire changing nature of the economy from actual material, from the making of material things to a kind of an electronic dream, to outsourcing of jobs, to people kind of losing the sense of where they were because suddenly they were living in cyberspace. There was a lot of literal melting down of the physical world, and I think that now we're waking up from it and sort of saying, oh, what is my body? What is my house? What is my job? Where am I? And it's a time that philosophically, I think, undid everyone without people noticing it.
Well, everybody sees the network that you do your weekly commentaries on as being a liberal network. I heard Rush Limbaugh say, what do they mean? You know, the media is conservative. They have NPR. They got 30 million listeners. And so the suggestion would be that they're uncritical of those liberal figures that seem to typify that political philosophy. But you were, as I remember, how did you, let me put it this way, I'll ask you directly. I mean, how did you see Bill Clinton and Al Gore?
Well, I saw them as middle-of-the-road Democrat Republicans. I didn't see them philosophically that... I saw them as part of a new kind of government that represented the interests of a new economy. But there was still a battle between the old economy and the new economy, and it's still going on. And in a sense, the new administration represents a good deal of the old economy, which is oil and armaments and things of that nature. But Clinton and Gore were not, you know, particularly interested in the welfare of society at large. They just represented a different class of producers. And so, they sort of amused me along with everybody else, and I was amused when the president's penis was the greatest news we had. You know, that's why probably it seems like a golden age now, when things like that kind of completely overwhelmed public awareness. But I always had a sense of impending doom, actually, when things are going so well. But maybe that's just my... you know, Transylvanian volcanic pessimism, automatic.
Well, it may be, you know, as you're saying, when the greatest thing facing our nation is a crisis of whether the president told the truth or not about his girlfriend and whether or not he actually had sex with her, depending on how you define sex.
Yeah, boy, I missed those days.
Yeah, I was thinking, can you imagine any woman or wife in your life of trying to convince her that what they did wasn't really sex? I don't think that would have flown too well. But
not to the women I know, because they know better.
Yeah. Well, I think Hillary probably knew better as well. Hey, Andrei Codrescu, you do a lot of media appearances, and I was looking at your website. You can just go to codrescu.com, am I correct?
Yeah,
and let me spell that just for people that may not know how to that don't know their Romanian very well. codrescu.com.
And yeah, I always tell people it's like code, secret code, and rescue at sea. That will usually get them, but not, you know, that's what it sounds like. But you spelled it right.
There you go. And I think I've told you in the past, like you, I rarely watch television, but you certainly have been on all of these shows that I was just astounded, like you've been on the Letterman show. How did that come about? I mean, somehow the mixture of Andrei Codrescu and David Letterman.
Well, it must be my accent. They don't really hear what I'm saying. Well, I went on there because I made a film called The Rhodes Scholar, R-O-A-D. And I guess the publicity machine of the distributor got me there on Letterman, and then Jay Leno and a few of those shows. Well, actually, it was quite interesting to see what that was like, which is to say nothing, really. I mean...
Well, I mean, like I said, it didn't seem like a mixture that would really work. I mean, did you get the feeling they were comfortable with you? Because the film is... wasn't a mainstream film. It was an excellent film, and it's available, I believe, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
It is. Well, you know, Letterman was not comfortable at all, and neither was I. And I was told by his producer I could only tell two stories I told him on the phone. And when I got there, of course, I forgot completely what stories they were, and I told some other ones, and there seemed to be general panic around the set. So the guy is not as spontaneous as he seems. And then... no, it was great, actually. He came to the green room before, and we talked about politics and stuff he'd read in the newspapers. And he seemed like a genuinely interested citizen.
Hmm. You know, I was just reading something that, and this kind of way out from left field, hey, where else would it come from me, right? About sexuality, because I know that that many of your novels concern, you know, different questions about sexuality, and many of it. Am I right in saying that that most of your novels are, as you indicated about Wakefield, your latest, these essentially philosophical slash political investigations of what our lives are all about? Well, it used to be. Back in beginning in like in the late 50s with the Bohemians, and then into the Beatniks, and then into the whole cultural explosion in the 1960s, that sexuality was part of a revolt. Now it is everywhere, and it is, you know, used to sell everything under the sun. So some artists, some cultural critics have been saying that actually the use of sexuality in art has become reactionary. In the way before, its presentation was avant-garde, revolutionary, it's now had become full circle almost.
Well, I'm not so sure about that. Because sexuality, first of all, there are a number of sexualities, and secondly, it depends what relation the sexual statement is in vis-a-vis the culture around it. I mean, in the 1950s and early 60s, sexuality was revolutionary because everybody was so uptight, and things were considered unspeakable. Things about the body and sex are considered unspeakable, and then, of course, just, you know, as you've said, the advertising took as much sexual content as it could handle, and is bursting at the seams with it. And, you know, I think the artists, in order to stay ahead, have to create more and more subversive expressions of sexuality, or else, you know, asceticism being one of them. I mean, asceticism is a form of revolt. I mean, refusing to say, you know, the easy excitement of the Victoria's Secret commercials. I was sorry to see Bob Dylan finally give in. And, it was a very sad day, actually.
I don't understand those guys. I mean, they must have trillions of dollars. Why would they do that?
That's what I thought, too. I mean, what's the point? Now he's going to also be on Idol Worship, or whatever the show is called, Finding a New Idol.
Oh, American Idol.
Oh, I mean,
I've never seen it.
I haven't either, but I heard Bob Dylan was going to be on it, and I think it's because he survived his own. Maybe he's not Bob Dylan anymore. Maybe he's just a body that's animated by aliens or maneuvered long distance. I can't believe the Dylan I know and love is actually doing this, but, you know.
I always think of him in Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid.
Right. Maybe he has a lot of cats or something.
Yeah. Andrei Codrescu is my guest just for a couple minutes more. And remember, Friday, May 14th, Andrei will be in Detroit at the Scarab Club in the Cultural Center, across in the back of the Art Institute. That's where the Scarab Club is. 7:30 p.m. He's going to read from his brand new novel, Wakefield. And how do you feel about, I mean, poetry really demands to be read aloud. And I've always enjoyed your poetry readings. I wonder, though, about reading from a novel. How do you feel about that?
Well, I'm going to leave out every third word.
Okay.
So it'll be just like poetry. Plus, the book describes the last subversive sexuality left. And we're going to fist people at the door to make sure there are no advertisers there.
Okay, wait a minute. I suspect you're not going to tell us what the last subversive sexuality is. We'll have to...
Well, I have to read the book.
Yeah, I have to read the book. And let me see. I've got... Okay, it's Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill, which is a division of Workman Publishing. So you can pick that up, and it is on the stands now, or what do we say, in the bookstores now. And I always urge people to go to their independent bookstores first. I have on my website, if you go to books, peterwerby.com, you can get a list of at least several independent bookstores in Detroit. Have you ever experienced any censorship from the chains?
Yes.
Really?
Yeah, because most of the chains put their the upfront books that publishers pay for placement.
Oh, in that manner.
And if your publishers don't pay for it, if they have your book at all, it will be under some nasty pile at the very end of the store.
Mm-hmm. You know, you've done, in fact, gee, 30 seconds left for a question like this. You've done so much poetry, so much fiction in the last few years. Any one of the two a greater love than the other?
Well, poetry. I mean, this novel is just a big casing for a bunch of poetry.
Okay. Andre Kodreski, I look forward to seeing you as usual. Friday, May 14th, 7:30 p.m., the Scarab Club Cultural Center in back of the Art Institute. Tom Robbins says of Andre Kodreski's new novel, Wakefield. Wakefield zigzags on wheels of comic brilliance, totally flattening a lot of useless architecture, physical and psychological, along the way. Andre, as usual, thanks for being with me.
Oh, Peter, it's great talking to you. Let's talk forever.
Thank you for tuning in to the Riffs Night Call. Night Call is a public affairs presentation of 101 WRIF Detroit. The opinions expressed on the show do not necessarily reflect those of the management or sponsors of WRIF Radio or Greater Media Detroit. Night Call is hosted every Sunday night by Peter Werby. Now stay tuned for more Riff Rock, coming right up on 101 WRIF Detroit.
Are you talking to me?
You know, I'm talking about Rock Financial. You really don't want to talk about mortgages today, do you?
I don't know. I guess we should get into it. Maybe a little smart arm talk.
Well, this is important to some people, and there are two of them from what I understand.
Yeah, we got a couple of them now. We got a 3-year under 3%, and we got a 5-year under 4%. A lot of folks, 3-year, maybe it's too short for them.
I can stretch it out.
Stretch it out. Longer, bigger, better, 3-year, 5-year, 3%, 4%. Folks have to take advantage of them because I think that the key message is rates are still historically low, and whether you're purchasing or refinancing, we still got to get the message out. A lot of folks need our help.
You got to jump into a house right now.
Right now.
It's going to be too late someday.
Let's
and you're
going
to feel bad about it, and you're going to wish you'd listen to us right now.
Time to go. Giddy up.
$80,000 or your $200,000 or your $500,000 and come to Rock Financial.
Whatever the loan amount. Actually, it's all the way up to $2 million. $80,000, $50,000, $100,000, $500,000. We don't care.
That's the one I want.
Yeah, we'll get you that one.
Okay.
Right, yeah.
From Rock Financial, Michigan's largest mortgage company, call the mortgage experts today at 800-333-ROCK or visit them online at rockfinancial.com. Our Quicken Loans Company, Equal Housing Lender, call 800-333-ROCK.
That's the Rock.
Yeah.
Whose motorcycle is this?
It's a chopper, baby.
This Wednesday night, the Riff and Wild Woodies are proud to bring you the Miss Detroit Choppers Calendar Girl Competition.
From the ceiling to the dance floor, Wild Woodies is bursting at the seams with the most outrageous people, the hottest beats, and an insane atmosphere you won't find anywhere else.
Rev up your engine and join the Riff's Dock of Rock, Doug Podell, this Wednesday night as the Detroit Choppers check out Metro Detroit's lovely ladies to be on their calendar and give away cash and prizes.
Wednesday night is also ladies' night. That means snow cover and drink specials for ladies 18 and up.
Stay late and join the uninhibited elite and Metro Detroit's most beautiful people packed in the room to capacity for the hottest Wednesday night dance party around.
Sponsored by Tycoon.
This Wednesday night, the Riff and Wild Woodies want you to enjoy the ride as the Detroit Choppers look for their new calendar girls.
Wild Woodies on Gratiot, just off I-94 in downtown Roseville.
Walmart Hobby Center, the ultimate recreational superstore.
Hi, Christine Michael here for Walt Michaels RV Center. You know, family vacations are supposed to be fun, but sometimes they can turn really stressful really quick. Busy airports, long security lines, delayed flights, lost luggage, that's no fun, especially with the kids. Get more out of your next vacation and go RVing in a Walt Michaels RV. You don't need any reservations. You just go wherever you want, whenever you want. Your kids will love it, and you get to take more than just one little suitcase. The best part is your vacation starts the moment you leave your driveway. So get more out of your next vacation and go RVing in a Walt Michaels RV. Come and see us. We're on the North I-94 Service Drive in Belleville, also known as the Walt Michaels RV Mile, or call us at 800-697-2500. We've got an RV for everyone's budget. We'll be looking for you.
More unstoppable ride. Next on The Riff. The following is a recreation of actual events. This was Jim's life before Sparkles.
Hey, Michelle, are you busy this Friday? Because...
Kim, you know what? I'm really busy right now, so could you just head back to your cube now? Thanks.
Now, since his visit to Sparkles, Jim's more confident and more attractive.
Michelle, cancel your plans. I'm taking you out on the town this Friday night.
I thought you'd never ask me, Jim. I'd love to go out with you and, of course, celebrate your big promotion.
Look great and feel confident with your new Sparkle smile. Call 1-877-SPARKLES. That's 1-877-SPARKLES. Sparkles is Metro Detroit's only one-hour teeth whitening center that will change the way people see you in about an hour. Sparkles in downtown Birmingham. It's easy. You deserve whiter teeth and a brighter smile. So call Sparkles. That's 1-877-SPARKLES. Sparkles, brightening Metro Detroit one smile at a time.
Another Riff listener.
If you're caller 33, you get a key.
Are you serious?
I'm serious.
No way.
Yeah.
Oh, hell yeah, man. You guys don't even know how long I've been trying to win.
Another key winner.
I swear to God, the Riff is the greatest radio station in the world.
You're right.
Man, that's awesome.
The Riff Harley Fest 2004.
Your next chance to score a key is coming soon.
From
101 WRIF Detroit.
Riff rocks.